Good afternoon. Welcome to the Joint Interim Committee on the Special Session. Thank you for being here. I want to talk about what our plan is for today and a little bit about tomorrow. And we have a set of things we need to take care of, and we have some folks here to testify, and then we have lots of people here for public testimony. I want to start off by thank you for being here. Special sessions are an unusual thing, and we here in the legislature and legislative leadership are trying to be as transparent as possible given an unusual timeline. And what we have today is a set of topics, but we also know people might be here to testify on different topics that we will cover more in depth tomorrow. So we want to allow for some flexibility for that as well. We're going to start off. First of all, I want to mention if you're not able to get in this room, obviously we are streaming, but also there are overflow rooms on the hall here. So if you don't have a seat and you're standing in the back, there is overflow seating, and we can always call you from there. There are screens in each of the rooms. We have to start off with adoption of committee rules, and then we will proceed to an informational meeting, starting off with the governor with some opening remarks. And we are here primarily today to talk about LC 1 and 2. We don't have official bills until we're in the session on Monday, but we have legislative concepts that can start the basis of the conversation. These are not final drafts. We are looking for input, and I just want to be very clear about that, since they are not final bills. So we look forward to hearing specific suggestions on changes in the language, if you have those ideas. We will also be talking about LC 5, which is related to what was Senate Bill 633 during the previous session we just completed. And we will probably start off with the PERS portions first, perhaps go to PERS testimony and then move on to the testimony and information on LC 5. I'll talk a little bit more about public testimony when we get there, but just to give you some forewarning for those who are here to testify publicly, we will be doing a two-minute limit so we can hear as many people as possible. So if you have notes, be judicious. Try to stick to your time. So you might want to look at your notes now and see how you can highlight that. If you have written testimony to submit, we will have the testimony. So if you have multiple pages and you only have 2 minutes, try to be selective in what you actually say. With that, my co-chair, the eminent Senate President, do we have a motion on the rules? Excuse me. I will open an organizational meeting to consider adoption of the rules.
Chuck Hotek, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules that are dated September 26, 2013.
Senate President Courtney moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 26, 2013. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, any objections? Seeing none, so moved. With that, we'll close the organizational meeting. And we'll move on to invited testimony by opening an informational meeting. And I'd like to call our first invited guest, Governor of the State of Oregon, John Kitzhaber. Thank you for joining us, Governor.
Madam Speaker, members of the committee, for the record, John Kitzhaber, Governor of the State of Oregon. I appreciate very much you giving me an opportunity to say a few words today, and I guess what I'd like to do, and I may run over 2 minutes a little bit, but I'll do my very best to respect the time frames. I want to try to provide sort of a larger context for why we're here before I make some very brief comments on the two bills that you'll have before you today are legislative drafts. You know, it is an extraordinary move for a governor to call a special session, and I don't take this lightly. But I felt at the end of the last session, as productive as it was, that there was still some unfinished business that this state and this legislature and this administration needed to accomplish. In spite of the slow recovery that we're experiencing, there are still school districts that are laying off teachers in our state and cutting school days. Tuition continues to go up relentlessly in our post-secondary institutions at the very time when tens of thousands of Oregonians need access to post-secondary education and training to rejoin the workforce. We still don't have access to a dedicated funding source for mental health that has everything to do with success in college, in grade school, and in career. We have underfunded support for low-income families at the time they need it the most, and we have not provided the same kind of focus on our family and small businesses that we have granted to our larger, more established businesses. I recognize that that this session is a huge interruption for all of you. People have had to change their plans. People have had to change their vacations. Some of you are dealing with difficult personal and family issues. So I deeply appreciate and understand the sacrifice this is to come down here. But I have huge confidence in the willingness and in the ability of this legislature, of this legislative leadership, of the Speaker, of the President, of Senator Ferrioli and Representative McClain, to come together and create consensus around a series of difficult issues for our state and for our future. And nobody will ever know how hard you work and the long hours and difficult decisions and negotiations that you have undertaken over the last couple of weeks. Let me briefly start with what was Senate Bill 633. That passed the Senate but died over in the House, that would preempt counties from adopting their own ban on genetically engineered products, with the exception of the election in Jackson County that's already on the ballot. There's no question that this bill falls outside the framework for which I initially called the special session, but the fact is it is a part of the framework that was agreed upon in the legislative leadership, a framework that I endorse and that I will help enforce as this package moves through the legislature. But I think it's important to recognize a distinction. This is about whether or not we think we should have 36 different agricultural policies around GE or whether we should have one state policy. It is not a debate about whether or not we want an agricultural industry that includes genetically engineered products. And that's a significant distinction. We already have genetically engineered products in Oregon, feed corn, sugar beets, for example. We also have areas, small organic growers, important local economies and markets that depend on products that don't have genetically engineered aspects. We've got parts of our state that would be devastated with the introduction of GE products, our robust wheat export industry. And we have seed farmers who are concerned about the contamination of their specialty seeds by anything else, whether it's GE or not GE. So it's a complex issue. And it's an issue that involves a full hearing. And it is my intention to ensure that we have that before the 2015 legislature so we can debate this in much more detail and try to arrive at a rational policy that addresses the complex concerns that surround this issue. On the PERS bill, as you know, when I put together my budget for the 2013-15 biennium, it was clear to me that the crisis in school funding and that the crisis in the funding of state services was no longer just a revenue, it was also a cost issue. We anticipated an increase of about $1,000 per student in this biennium, and about half of that came from the public employees' retirement system. So I included this in my budget, a bill that modified the COLA, which is essentially what you're considering here today, after consultation with the head of every public employee union in the state and three meetings with the Labor PERS Coalition, because I respect these public workers, because these are, in fact, benefits that they earned and deserved. This is not about the value of our public workers. This is not about the quality of the work that they do. These are our teachers. These are the people that run our prisons, our first responders, our daycare providers. They are our friends. They are our neighbors. They are members of our community. And I deeply respect the work that they do. And that has been reflected in my effort to negotiate fair contracts with our public employees. This year, we've provided health care to home health workers who have never had it before. We have eliminated furlough days because we respect the value of their work. And last night, we concluded a fair settlement with the classified workers in our Oregon University system. So what this is really about is an effort to maintain a stable retirement system while having the resources to invest in schools today so that our kids can be successful tomorrow. And that is essentially what we're trying to do in this piece of legislation. I would just like to close, Madam Speaker and members of the committee, by saying this isn't easy for any of us. This is a large undertaking. And I think that we, for a moment, need to pull what we're trying to do away from the numbers and the inside the building score sheets about who got what and who wins and who loses in Salem and think about real people. I was at Hallman Elementary School this morning in Salem. That will add three teachers this year. In Elgin, they will add two elementary teachers taking their class size from the low 30s to the low 20s and a music teacher that they haven't had since the recession. This is really about real, real people. And I guess I want to make an appeal to not to you, but to the people who are behind me, to the members of the lobby. Because whether you're a member of OLCV, whether you are a public employee, whether you are a business, a corporation that's going to see your taxes go up. Our ability to succeed here has everything to do with you. You and your families and your future will be impacted by our ability to provide education to our kids and access to post-secondary education and caring for the mentally ill and caring for our seniors and focusing on struggling small and family businesses. So I ask you, even though you advocate for one piece or another piece of this legislation, to remember that you are also Oregonians and you are also citizens. And I think to the legislature that we have a moment here in this state, given what's going on in Washington, D.C., a group of people about to shut down the federal government, to demonstrate to Oregon and to this nation that we are better than our best days, that we have the capacity to appeal to the noblest aspects of our citizens and the citizens of this country and demonstrate that we can come together and do the right thing for Oregon because we are Oregonians. We have the capacity to do that, and I'm confident that we will. Thank you.
Thank you, Governor. Colleagues? We'll entertain maybe a question or two.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Thank you, Governor, for your persistence. Having been in those meetings with you, I can attest to your work ethic, and it's exceptional. One question I have is, as part of the agreement, you've made some public statements and as well as private statements with regards to this being a package. Would you clarify for the record here for everyone, when you have referenced that this is a package, they all pass or none pass, are you pledging that you will veto, affirmatively veto, all the bills unless they all come to your desk?
Madam Chair, Representative McLean, yes, I am. I mean, I regret that we have the lack of trust in the building that requires that, but I commit to each and every one of you that the elements of this package all have to pass and receive my signature, or I will not allow them to become law.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Governor.
Madam Chair.
Oh, excuse me. Senator?
Thank you, Mayor.
Almost got out.
No, not going to happen. Well, I too, have to commend the state's chief executive for not just the persistence in the near term, in the recent past, but also you made this a mission to take up this unfinished business, visiting communities up the I-5 corridor, up the I-84 corridor, into the interior. You really went around the horn to talk to people about what you're characterizing as the unfinished business of the state. And it does culminate in an agreement and a special session. I join with my colleague from the House to call out what I think is a remarkable investment of time and energy that brings us to this point. So that we can have an informed discussion on what the package will do for Oregonians. It is remarkable, and I think it serves all Oregonians, and I'm frankly quite impressed by that dogged determination to bring us to a place where we can take up that unfinished business. So I just wanted to call that out, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you,
Governor, for starting us off. We very much appreciate it. And just to be clear, because we have so many folks in public testimony, that's why there's a time limit. Our information, our invited guests who are here today to give us the background details, we'll have a little bit more time. So just so everyone knows. So we will move on to Legislative Concept 1 and Legislative Concept 2, Public Employee Retirement System, if Paul and Marissa could join us up here. So colleagues, the goal of the informational here is to hear from our expertise from Legislative Council and then the PERS Board to talk to us about these two concepts. So if we could allow them to get through their opening comments, and then we'll take some questions. So keep a list. I don't know who wants to start. Paul? Marissa?
Oh, Chair Kotek, Chair Courtney, members of the committee. Would you like me to walk through the concepts, or if you have questions about them now, how would you like me to assist you? I'm Marissa James from Legislative Council, Deputy Legislative Council.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative, or Senator.
Madam Chair, I don't know if I reflect the rest of the committee, but I am very familiar with the COA concept. But in terms of the concept that has the three other concepts within it for PERS, I would like some more time to actually read and digest it before I ask questions. So.
Thank you, Senator. So we have LC1 and LC2 in front of us. I believe these are also online.
And I can also tell you briefly what they do, if that would be helpful.
There's some problems. That would be helpful.
I think that would be helpful, but perhaps let's start off with one.
Okay. So LC1 contains the concepts relating to the cost of living adjustments. The first portion of the bill or the draft is identical to Senate Bill 857 from the 2013 session, and it further modifies the cost of living adjustment that was established in Senate Bill 822. So for members who have a yearly allowance of up to $60,000, their allowance would be increased by 1.25% starting in 2014. The 1.5% COLA that was already applied in 2013, that is not changed. And then for dollars over $60,000 would be get a COLA of 0.15%. So that should be, you should be all be familiar with that concept.
And colleagues, we do have a letter from Milliman directed to Paul Clear in Oregon PERS that does have that chart in right in front page if you need a, you're a visual learner. So.
Right. Madam Co-Chair, Paul Clary, Executive Director of PERS. You can see that comparison on that first page between the four tiers that are currently in statute in Senate Bill 822 and how that will change to two tiers under this bill.
On page four of the concept, in section six, is just a fix to an issue about alternate payees who are in a divorce situation. An ex-spouse might receive part of a person's benefit. So that's just a fix to the calculation of the COLA that was requested by PERS for those people. And then on page eight is the concept of the supplementary payments, which directs PERS to issue a supplementary payment of 0.25% of a retiree's allowance for a person with a yearly allowance up to $20,000. And PERS may, if PERS finds it to be reasonably prudent, do the same thing, a 0.25% supplementary payment for people up to $60,000. And those increases are yearly, but they're sunsetted in 2019. During that session, before that session, PERS will report on whether its recommendations about the cost of living and the supplementary payments, and then the legislature can consider in the 2019 session whether to continue those, change the COLA. And the rest of the concept is your typical sections. It provides for expedited review to the Supreme Court and has an emergency clause, although the next COLA wouldn't happen until July of 2014.
Thank you, Marissa. Paul, just announce yourself for the record. And then.
Chair Kotek, members of the committee, I'm Paul Clary, Executive Director of PERS. You have before you a couple of things from us. One is the a Milliman letter. We kind of anticipated that 857 might be the bill that you at least start with in the special session. So we asked for this analysis. It also includes what was in 857, which was the change in money match, but we won't talk about those numbers because that's not part of this bill at all. The standalone changes to the COLA are still in effect. So if you'll turn to the page 3, the chart up at the top, you can see the second line shows the effect of the Senate Bill 822 benefit changes. We had and those changes were a modification of the COLA and elimination of the tax remedy for non-residents. That reduced our accrued liability. I'm looking at the second column there, accrued liability, which is our UAL, by $2.6 billion. and reduced our rates, the total, the last column there, by 2.5%. The additional effect of this COLA change that we're looking at is the third line. So you're seeing a liability reduction of $1.9 billion and a rate reduction of 2%, accrued liability reduction. These numbers are based on our December 31, 2011 valuation, because that's the valuation we had available when we ran these mid-September. Just today, we got finalized our December 31, 2012 valuation. And that valuation reflects the new methods and assumptions that the board directed the actuary to include in it. And one of those is a reduction in our assumed earnings rate. We're dropping our assumed earnings rate, or the direction to the actuary was to run that valuation with an assumed earnings rate of 7.75%. When you do that, that increases the cost of your liabilities because you're assuming now that those assets that we've got in the fund are going to earn less going forward. So cost of liabilities go up. Anytime you can reduce liabilities, the value of that reduction goes up as well. So we've got a paragraph in this letter on page 7 that describes that if you had us run these numbers today using the 2012 valuation, and it's kind of the third paragraph down, end of that, if you had them run these today using the valuation that was just completed, the impact on the UAL would be about $5 billion from the combination of Senate Bill 822 and the COLA reductions here. Again, we want to give you the most up-to-date information as possible. If this special session were a month from now, we would have run this entire thing based on the 12 valuation. But that's the reason why the numbers change a little bit. I can tell you, though, no matter how you measure it, a $4.5 billion or a $5 billion reduction in liabilities is a substantial reduction in liabilities. We're talking about a one-third reduction from what we had at the end of 2011. We were about a $16 billion unfunded liabilities when we exclude employer side accounts. So substantial reduction in unfunded liabilities and a 4.5% reduction in employer rates combined through both of these is a substantial reduction in employer rates going forward. So that's kind of the numbers. I did want to talk a little bit about this chart here because I think this is, do we have that, Marjorie?
Yeah. Yes, they do. Okay. Before you do that, Paul, could you just talk briefly about how the additional changes in the COLA would affect the collaring that we did in 822?
Chair Kotek, members of the committee, I appreciate you bringing that up. Our suggestion is that if you pass this bill, we swap out these liability reductions for the rate deferral. You'll recall that we had a budget note rate deferral that was going to, in essence, that was you pay $350 million less this biennium to employers, but you're going to make that up over the next 20 years, and the cost of making that up was 0.3% of payroll, a pretty hefty carrying charge. We've now got an opportunity with this bill to swap out the liability reductions and eliminate that rate deferral. So the employers would see an additional benefit of avoiding that cost increase of 0.3%. So it really is a significant benefit to employers for us to eliminate that deferral if we can. I mean, it was done for short-term budgetary needs, and everyone understands that. But if you can substitute short-term budget savings with long-term real savings and avoid the carrying charge, it's really something that we would encourage. And I think the draft bill, we eliminated the direction for the board to recalculate rates, and that will allow us to do that. And that's another advantage we see of this.
Yes. Senator Devlin?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Cleary, part of when we hold a hearing like this and we bring a person forward like you, we try to get some information on the record and also for people to understand why we're taking the action we're taking. There has been quite a bit of discussion both in this building and in the papers about collaring. And I just would like you to speak briefly about the magnitude of the losses to the system in 08 and the fact that the PERS board itself had to collar rates
right.
in 09, 11, 11, 13, and in 13, 15. So it is not a new concept. It is actually because of the magnitude, and if you could go into that, I think it would be helpful.
Chair Kotek, Senator Devlin, be happy to. In 2008, we had a negative 27% earnings, market meltdown across the world. For us, I believe that was about a $17 billion loss. In order to make that up, we were looking at somewhere 11 to 12% rate increase. We knew we couldn't implement that in a single biennium. And so we use a method called, it's a rate smoothing method called rate collaring. And so we scheduled to spread that increase out over three biennia. And we started into it with 9/11. I think we went up somewhere around 4.5%, and we were going to go up another 4.5% this biennia before 13-15, before the 822 changes. And then we were looking at another 4 or 5 that still was in the wind. We do everything on a fair market value basis here in Oregon. We think it's a lot more transparent. A number of systems do what's called asset smoothing. They'll take 5 to 8 years to recognize those losses on the front end. We just think it's a lot more easy to explain that, you know, we lost $17 billion and we went from a $63 billion fund to a $44 billion fund or so almost overnight. And as a result, you know, we had to start filling that hole with contribution increases. But we wanted to spread those out over time. So, yes, the board uses an administrative collar, and I can kind of explain that a little bit off of this chart as well.
Thank you, Paul. You want to continue with the chart? Thank you.
So this is a chart from a presentation from our July 26 board meeting. It's also reflected in the 2012 valuation presentation that now is up on our website, so anyone in the audience can go there and find it. It's going to be given to the board tomorrow afternoon at our board meeting. What this is kind of a what we call a deterministic projection of rate increases. And I want you to focus on the green line. That is the line that reflects all the actuarial changes, method and assumption changes that the board has endorsed, including a 7.75% assumed earnings rate. This is inside baseball, but we had to change our cost allocation to what's called entry age normal, EAN, to comply with new accounting standards. We modified our collar a little bit, and we took our UAL and amortized it over 20 years. Again, we use one of the shortest amortization periods in the nation, but we think it's important to pay our bills over the anticipated remaining working span of our workers, so we use a 20-year amortization period. So the green line shows rates in 11-13. It also shows the impact of Senate Bill 822. So those rates in 13-15 would have popped up 4.5%. Instead, they only went up about 0.5. The next rate increase we're scheduled in 15-17 is to up to about 19.1%. That's about 2.6%. This bill, if passed, with the rate deferral eliminated and the 2% gain from the liability reductions, will then, from that point forward, knock every one of those points down by 2.3%. So instead of going up 4.5 in 17-19, we'd be going up about 2. And then every one of those other points going forward will be 2.3% lower. And that's a huge savings to employers across the state. Remember, we're talking about $800 million or so a biennia that grows at our payroll growth rate of 3.75. So this is multiple billions of dollars that are saved over this 20-year amortization period just with those type of adjustments. If the bill passes, we'll run all new financial projections and all that, and we'll reflect everything in it. But I just wanted to share this with you because people need to see we're a long-term system. we have to, and the budget stability, I think, we're going to be able to provide with the passage of this bill to our employers. You can see the significance of that. Instead of them looking at, you know, a 3, 4% increase in each of the next two biennia, they'd be looking at about a 2.6 and a 2. Much better than the alternative.
Madam Chair.
Senator Devlin.
My one last indulgence here. Just so the committee understands this and the audience understands that even though you're reducing those to those levels, that's 2% and 2.6 on a number that for all public employees that are within the system, on about probably a growing payroll that's right now in the $18 to $19 billion range.
Right.
So they're not small numbers. Even though they're small percentage points, they're not actually small numbers. They're very large numbers.
Right, right. Yeah, when you apply our rates times the biennial payroll, right now it's 18.4 and it's projected to grow to 19 and 20 in the future, it does generate significant savings and significant costs. So again, that's what we're looking for. And I think the idea here with this bill, again, is you try to spread the burden. The COLA impacts everyone. It impacts current retirees, future retirees, current members, future members. So you've spread the burden across as big a population as you possibly can, and you've done it in a manner that it doesn't hit any particular individual as significantly as some of the other alternatives that we've looked at. Remember, we've looked at things that could reduce one individual's benefits by 40%. We're not talking that at all with these COLA changes.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Paul. It sounds like that was the opening presentation. Comments, questions for our PERS expert and Elsie on the drafting?
I might comment, Chair Kotek, just a little bit on these supplemental payments, because that is something that's different that we don't cover in this letter. It's not something that's going to affect our unfunded liability. The payment would come out of our contingency reserve. We look at that, and if you know, we just looked at our August payroll, and we said if everybody under 60,000, we paid another 0.25%, it would cost us somewhere $6.5 million or so 1 year. So if you did that, you know, for six, we're talking maybe $40 to $60 million. We've got a $600 million contingency reserve. So if this bill were to pass, we'd look at that. We'd probably segregate that out initially and see what we can do to try to get that type of payment across the board. We know that for the lower amounts, it's only about $1.5 million or so. So, you know, for the mandatory $20,000 or less, it'll be $1.5 million. For everybody, it'd be about $6.5 million. It doesn't get compounded into the benefit, and that's the big change. And a number of systems across the nation have moved to these type of COLAs because it's the compounding effect that drives up the cost of the COLA. Our compound 2% COLA, we figure, adds about 20% to the cost of the benefit. We're now effectively reducing that to about a 1.25 COLA, so you can see how much we've reduced the cost of the benefit from that perspective. You know, there's a number of systems that don't give any COLA, so we're still at least providing some under this.
And thank you. So just to clarify, that's page 8 and 9 of LC1. That is a change from not only are the inactives piece that was in the previous bill not here, but this is an attempt to recognize that for lower-wage retirees, we understand the shift is more the most challenged to that population. We're trying to come up with a mechanism to help mitigate some of that with this.
That's what we understand, Chair Kotek, and we're saying that we think that's an affordable and a reasonable approach that we can cover with the funds in our contingency reserve.
Thank you. The questions about LC1? Now let's move on to LC2, where, and again, I know we've talked a lot about the COLA, but it's always good to revisit exactly what we're doing and what the numbers are. LC2, excuse me, is more of specific policy changes to PERS. So, Marissa, do you want to walk us through that?
Sure. Chair Kotek, members of the committee, LC2 contains three additional concepts related to PERS. The first one addresses a specific situation where an employee receives a raise during the final 3 years of their employment that raise is intended to pay for insurance coverage that the employer paid for previously. The first concept here removes those increases in salary from final average salary, which is used to calculate the member's pension. So, and it's very narrowly tailored to address that specific situation, and it only applies to increases in salary paid on or after the effective date. The second concept, currently pension payments coming out of PERS or other payments coming out of PERS cannot be garnished or attached or executed on to collect a judgment, to collect a judgment. The second concept, which is sections 3, 4, and 5, would allow payments coming out of PERS to be garnished or executed on to collect a money award included in a judgment in a criminal action. So if a PERS member, or it could be a beneficiary, commits a crime and there's restitution or a fine that results in a money award in a criminal judgment, their PERS payments could be garnished to collect that judgment. And that only applies to judgments entered on or after the effective date. And the third one, which you might be most interested in, is affects the status of legislators in the public employees' retirement system. People who are elected or appointed to the legislature can be several different types of people with regard to their PERS status. So you could be an active member of PERS, you're in a PERS-covered employment. You could be an inactive member, you used to work in PERS-covered employment and your account is still there. You could be a retired member of PERS who is receiving a pension and now is coming to the legislature, or you could be a person who was never in PERS at all, never in public employment. So depending on what kind of person you are when you come to the legislature, you have different options for what kind of PERS options you have when you come to the legislature. Under this new concept, if you are not a PERS member at the time you're appointed or elected, retired, active, or inactive, then you can't become a PERS member for purpose of your service in the Legislative Assembly. So you could participate in the deferred comp program, and the legislature would make a contribution to that on your behalf. Or you could elect not to do that if you wanted to have nothing. If you are any kind of PERS member when you come to the legislature or when you're reelected to the legislature, you would have different options. You could be in PERS as a legislative member, you could decline to be in PERS as a legislative member and choose to take deferred comp, or you could choose to have nothing at all. And previously, if you were a OPSERP or Tier 3 member coming into the legislature, you could not opt out of PERS. This concept does make it possible for you to opt out of PERS. You'd have the same options as any other person. So for you people who are already in the legislature, it shouldn't change your options very much at all, because unless you opted out of PERS when you join the legislature and you're not a member, you will be members of PERS when you are reelected. But for people coming into the legislature in the future, if they are not a member of PERS when they are elected, they will not be able to be a member of PERS for purposes of service in the legislature.
So again, these three provisions apply to some different groups. So the insurance provision applies to OPSERP members. That's our open plan, anybody who was hired after sometime in August 2003. It applies to any increase in salary paid after this date. So that's OPSERP members only. The garnishment applies to all PERS members, Tier 1, Tier 2, and OPSERP, but applies to judgments entered after the date. And the legislative service, it expands the options for the OPSERP members, as Marissa indicated. It used to be once you were an OPSERP member, you could never get out of PERS, even though all of Tier 1, Tier 2 members could legislate for their legislative service, could elect not to be part of PERS. So that's expanded. And prospectively for new members, you're not going to be allowed to join PERS if you don't have any prior legislative service. So, but any existing member will have all the options that are available to them that they've got now, plus an expanded option for OPSERP members that they didn't have. So and I think that in terms of the contribution, the bill calls for if someone, these new members or people who elect to go into the deferred comp plan, what we call the Oregon Savings Growth Plan, the contribution would be the equivalent of the 6% member contribution plus the normal cost on OPSERP members.
All right.
Right. And so the normal cost on OPSERP members is projected to be about 8% in the next biennia. So you're looking at about a 14% contribution to Oregon Savings Growth Plan. People have asked me, will that generate a benefit similar to PERS? Hard to tell. Depends on the investment selections people make. Depends on what the market does. It used to be the formula for these defined contribution or 401k plans used to be 8-8-25-40. You put 8% in, you earn 8%, you start at age 25, and you do it for 40 years, retire at 65, and it would get you a benefit somewhat similar to PERS. I don't know, with the exception possibly of Senator Courtney, whether we've got a 40-year member in the legislature.
But, moving on. Thanks, Paul.
Sitting there so quietly.
Well, and I think colleagues and also members of the public, LC2 is there have been assorted bills, perhaps similar to some of the components in this bill, but to try to get them right, PERS is a very complicated system, so I want to definitely emphasize on this one, trying to make sure we get it right is probably one of the bigger challenges of the set of bills we have. So if you have feedback on either any of those components, it'd be very specific feedback. It's very much needed to make sure we get it right. I have Representative Garrett and Representative Parrish in the queue, and Senator Devlin.
Thank you. I have two questions regarding sections 3, 4, and 5 on garnishment. Can you just go over again why these apply to criminal judgments only, not civil judgments? And secondly, I believe the legislature has previously attempted to impose some consequence on pension recipients who commit crimes, and there's been some maybe attorney general opinion or court case on the constitutionality of that. So can you comment on that?
Yes. Chair Kotek, Representative Garrett. I don't know why it only applies to criminal judgments. It was requested to be that way. And with regard to the constitutionality of it, you would not be able to do this in a private pension circumstance. In some of the other concepts that have been floated around, the concept was to allow for forfeiture of a person's the corpus of their pension, and it also applied to both private and public pensions. You could not do it to a private pension, and it is a lot more complicated to try to accomplish forfeiture of the corpus of somebody's pension.
Well, is there any legal reason why we couldn't apply the same rule to civil judgments?
I don't believe so.
Thank you.
Representative Parrish?
Thanks.
Senator Devon.
So I just want to make sure I heard you correctly, that upon re-election, if we are in PERS, we can make the decision at that point to slide over into something else, those of us who are in PERS who didn't want to be in PERS?
Chair Kotek, Representative Parrish, yes, that'll be available to everyone, including OPSERP members like yourself.
Perfect.
Whereas up to now, it wasn't available for
OPSERP. Yes, we went rounds the first
right.
time.
Right.
Thank you.
Right.
Thank you, Senator Devon.
Being so deep into PERS, I don't think I'll ever get out.
Agent.
Yes. Representative Garrett's question about civil judgments. Maybe I'm misunderstanding something, and I'm not an attorney. But my understanding is that PERS members, just like any other member of the public, may go through a difficult divorce, may actually have part of their PERS payment diverted, to the other party in a settlement in that divorce, I think, do actually in civil judgments actually pay for child support. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering if the civil side is even needed, because in essence, it's happening already, and it's just a normal expectation. The one question I had, and I'm just maybe not misunderstanding what was said or what is in the bill, is on the issue, which is where someone basically is just going along in their normal course of employment, so that people understand this. And it's not that it's not the old issue of sick time, that's not in this bill. It's not the issue of vacation time, that's not in this bill. But an employer just decides, I've been paying $1,500 a month for the health insurance for this employee. I won't pay that anymore, but I'll give them $1,500 a month more to change their final average salary for the end so that they'll get a higher retirement. That's what you're trying to address here. But I heard you say that this is only going to apply to OPSERV. And I'm wondering why it doesn't apply to both, even though, you know, some tier members go under money match, some go under annuity plus formula, some go under full formula. Why it doesn't apply to tier one or tier two?
Chair Kotek, Senator Devlin, I believe you could apply those to tier one and tier two if you desired to. But I did want to mention, on your civil, the points you made about the civil judgments, those are actually in statute, the child support and the divorce. So actually, you could not, if you had, for example, a negligence case and you had a judgment for that, you could not garnish PERS to collect on that judgment.
Other questions? The panel? No? All right. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Committee will stand at ease for a moment. Thank you, colleagues, for... If I have everyone's attention, please. Committee's back in order here. excuse me. I apologize for the delay. We trying to decide how to move forward with at least an information on LC5. We don't have one posted yet, and for me that's a little bit of a challenge between the transparency of actually having a conversation about something, even though most people have seen the bulk of that bill from the last past session. So what I'd like to do, we're going to close the informational hearing. We're going to move to a public hearing and go to the PERS bills first. So I'm going to close the informational hearing and open a public hearing. Let me just talk a little bit about the ground rules. The purpose today for us is to receive public testimony. While I know there might be an interest in having a dialogue, there are so many folks who want to be here. We're here to listen. We also ask folks to keep their comments to 2 minutes because that allows everyone to say something. Again, if you have written testimony with you, please submit it. We will read it. I wouldn't read it verbatim. I understand people might be nervous, but try to get to the high points because we will have this clock here that will green, you're doing good. Is it yellow, red?
Yellow,
you're getting near the end, and red, time to move on to the next person. So I'm going to call people up in panels, 3 people or 2 or 3, depending on how they show on the list. And then I'll call an on-deck group who's next. So if you're in one of the overflow rooms, you'll know you're coming up next. You can come to the back of the room so we can keep people moving quickly. And also, hopefully people have marked if they have come more than 100 miles, we will prioritize you. And I know people have also come to talk about the other bills that we might be doing tomorrow. If we could start, we'll start with the sheets for LC 1 and 2. I also know folks have signed up for LC 5, but if you're here for the other LCs 3 and 4, which are related to the spending and the revenue side, we will cover those more in depth tomorrow, but we won't preclude you from coming in, but right now we're going to start with the PERS to try to keep thematically in the same spot. And with that, we have a tradition here in the Capitol that if legislators are here to testify, they will come up first, and then we will move to the rest of the list. And I think, Representative Frederick, you're the sole legislator here to testify on these bills, but we will keep you to the two minutes.
Huh?
We will stay to the 2 minutes, yes.
Okay. Thank you very much, Madam Speaker.
And Senator Whitson and Representative Whitson, my understanding is you weren't. You're good. Okay. And then on deck, let me look at these sheets. Representative Frederick, if you want, like to start. And
thank you. Thank you very much, Madam Speaker. I am, members of the committee co-chairs, I am Lou Fredericks, representing House District 43, that's North and Northeast Portland. I came here today to speak in opposition, frankly, to the entire package, and I'm going to tell you why in some detail, but I'm going to cut it down a great deal because you won't only give me 2 minutes. My first reason, and I've expressed this before in previous times, is that I think this is a terrible way to govern. Considering legislation with far-reaching effects, effects that will be difficult or impossible to reverse in this procedural environment, brings out, frankly, the worst in us. Brokered legislation packages encourage, in fact, they demand that we avoid exploring the real merits of the individual pieces. It all becomes part of a game, and the rules in this case are winner-take-all. I'm going to start off with the PERS things. As I understand this proposal, it will not spare those among those whose retirement is far from comfortable. The cost of living adjustment proposed is extremely low. I don't know the latest figures, but I did find that the average pension paid on retirement in 2011 was about $32,000 a year. Now, changes in the actual cost of living do not cut evenly across income groups. People who rely on a pension income of $32,000 a year or less are profoundly affected by some of the most volatile costs of rent, food, fuel, and that's an average. Many PERS pensions are much lower than that. And we are considering this today in advance of a Supreme Court ruling on SB 822. If it is ruled out, then what? If nothing else, we've wasted a lot of time on this. But the real issue for me is this. These people earn their retirement by working. The shift of wealth from those who work to those who speculate and manipulate is bringing this country down. We can talk all day about numbers, but these are people, human beings who invested their life's work in public service, and now we want to renege on the deal. It's beyond cynical to say that this is for kids or for schools or for teachers. Many of these human beings who would be touched by this proposal are retired educators. This is part of an ongoing theme of discounting and devaluing the teaching profession and the individuals who spend their lives getting good at it. And is that 2 minutes?
It was 2 minutes. Thank you, Representative. But I think that's thank you for going first, because I think that exemplifies for other folks how difficult it is to stay within 2 minutes. However, I hope you'll share your written notes with us to the committee.
I will do that. Possible. I had something to say about the GMO bill, and you know much of that, I'm sure. But
well, that might be later, so
I'll stick around.
You might get the privilege of coming back
you
on that if you'd like.
Much.
So, thank you, Representative. I would like to call Scott Winkles, Joel Fisher, and Jeremy Rogers on deck. Tim Stoll, Betty Crawford, and Avarice Morrow. Again, please announce your name for the record, and you have 2 minutes. And Jeremy?
I think he's coming from the other room.
There he is.
For the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm appearing in favor of Concepts 1 and 2. It's been well documented that we have a serious problem with our PERS system. The current unfunded actuarial liability of this system is about $14 billion, and that's a 20-year problem. We have heard today folks talking about the crisis in our classroom, the crisis in our public service levels, but the PERS rates haven't reached their cruising altitude yet. We're not currently at the rate we anticipate to be at for the next 20 years. In point of fact, if you read the Milliman actuarial analysis, we do not anticipate being below a 20% PERS rate once we hit cruising altitude until the 31-33 biennium. If we don't act now, we are looking at a 20-year problem, 20 years of reduced services, and for my members, the gap between what we raise and our costs and our revenue will continue to grow. And that means for my members, for our cities, that's fewer firefighters, that's fewer police officers, that's fewer library hours, that's diminished parks. With that, I'm going to close and turn it over to my colleagues and say that we do want to applaud the members of the legislature who worked very hard to create this framework, and now we urge every member of this legislature to affirm that fine work and pass this package and protect our service levels. Thank you.
Chair Courtney, Chair Kotek, for the record, my name is Joel Fisher, Senior Policy Analyst with the Oregon Business Association, although I'm not actually senior to anybody there. We're here to testify in support of this package. Great opportunity to be doing good things for Oregon, good things for Oregon students, good things for Oregon business, providing certainty for Oregon's farmers. And also just applaud all of the hard work that's been done. I think everybody knows just how much time, energy, effort has gone into that. We'd like to thank all of you for your hard work, the governor for his hard work, Legislative Revenue Office for their hard work, fiscal office as well. Urge you to move forward with this package and do a good thing for Oregon. Thanks.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Kotek, Co-Chair Courtney, Jeremy Rogers with the Oregon Business Council. We also encourage you to support the entire package of bills. And since I have such limited time, I just wanted to direct you to a handout that I provided, which calculated the benefits to financial benefits to school districts for every school district in the state. You'll see several columns in there where you can see what 822 saved for school districts, what the additional liability reduction from this package will save, what that totals, what the revenue saves or creates, and then totals. And just to reiterate what Mr. Cleary said, this is a significant investment in schools, and this document just shows you the school investment. But if you're talking about system-wide savings and the revenue, that's $1 billion-plus investment in Oregon this biennium, and for schools, counting all the liability reduction of the $4.6 billion and the revenue, that's about $360 million investment. So obviously a lot of that's already been achieved, and you have the whole collar issue. But this is a major deal, and we see it as a turning point for Oregon if we can achieve this. We also hope that it can help prevent what we see as a very negative ballot measure battle that might be coming if we don't do something significant. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you, gentlemen. And those who are new to the Capitol, we will have members getting up and down during the course of the hearing today. We will come back as soon as we can, so please don't take that as anything other than we have other business and we'll be moving it out of the hearing during the day. We will all try to stay as long as we can so we're not interrupting you while you're testifying. So we have Tim Stahl, Betty Crawford, and Avarice Morrow. On deck, we have David Rees, Val Jack, Mark Perlman, and Louise Curran. You might have to bring a fourth chair up with you on that. Again, just introduce yourselves for the record, and you each have 2 minutes.
Thank you. Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. I'm Tim Stelb of Roseburg. I'm the president of the Oregon School Employees Association and also a classified employee in the Roseburg School District. OSEA, as you know, represents 20,000 classified educational professionals throughout the state. You know them as cooks, custodians, secretaries, educational assistants, as well as many other classifications who love their job and what they do for our students. I'm here to voice our opposition to the additional cuts to our PERS retirement and ask that you please do not pit the needs of our children against the needs of our retirees. Our members have been out there helping districts through financial shortfalls by accepting hours reductions, salary freezes, and furlough days. Not all of these reductions have been restored. Yet today, here we are visiting further reductions for these members who have dedicated their lives to the education profession. These cuts are permanent. If passed, these reductions will make it even harder for our retirees who will be on fixed incomes to keep up with rising costs surrounding them. This is not the way I would thank someone for their years of commitment. Surely there must be a better way than taking promised benefits away from them. Some of my members are here this afternoon to share with you their own personal hardships that they have endured in support of education. These are real people, and what we will be considering in the days ahead have real consequences for them. Our members and I are imploring you to do the right thing and vote no on any further PERS reductions. You have my written testimony, and if you would please take a look at it because I have some more comments in there. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon.
Thank you, Tim.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is Everest Brawlier-Morrow. I'm a PERS retiree and I live in Portland, Oregon. Once again, I come before legislators who have the power to define my elder years. Once again, I would like to remind you that you're considering breaking contractual promises. Some of you seem willing to trade my future that I planned for, sacrificed for, and dedicated my adult working life for. I paid for my pension. I earned my pension. I was promised my pension. I exchanged my daily work for compensation, often very little compensation. After 30 years in one district, my final hourly wage as a highly qualified educational assistant was $14.61. I worked in a district where we suffered 2 school closures in the 80s, numerous wage freezes, cuts in hours and days, finally those famous furloughs that didn't qualify for unemployment. I saw my health care benefits rise to levels where eventually I had to drop my family members. But my PERS was supposed to be sacred. I paid my 6% into my PERS account, and I'm no gambler. I never put my money into the variable account because I wanted the security of knowing that I could expect to live on when I retired and not worry about losing it all with a fluctuating market. I never had extra money to put in anything but a conventional savings account. And the less money I earned because of cuts meant less money that went into my PERS. I certainly didn't have a high-powered, well-padded position with the state or a university coaching job. No extra vacation days to add to my PERS account. I will be not going to fancy places, and I will pay more for my health care costs as I age. Only God knows whether I will need assisted living or skilled nursing or memory care as I age. The results of reducing my COLA will be a lower financial return over my lifetime. impacting my livability as I age. I will also have less health or housing options, which could be potentially devastating to my family. I feel like I'm being punished because I dedicated my life to my students, my community, and my family. So why is it okay to treat public employees so disrespectfully? Because we're generally nice people who try very hard to be accommodating when school funding is inadequate. Apparently you think I'm expendable and powerless to prevent you from punishing me twice. Well, I may be retired, but I am not expired, and I ask you to reconsider any cuts to PERS. I ask that you remember a promise is a promise and a contract is a contract. I also ask you to remember that you are only as good as your word, and I will remember what you do here. Thank you.
Thank you, Emma. And it's early in the day, but we could try to save the 2 minutes, but thank you.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Betty Crawford, and I just retired after 17 years as a special ed assistant in Canby. During working years, my family suffered financially every time ballot measures or the economy hit the state budget. My children did without many things that other kids had. We ate a lot of ramen noodles. But I kept doing what I did because of children needing help. I was educating my community's children, and my family understood that. I stayed in my job because educating children has always been my passion since I was 7 years old, and I'm very proud of the work that I did. I also stayed because even though my take-home pay was very small, it insured me a pension when I retired. Excuse me. You see, my parents didn't have a pension when they retired, and I saw them struggle till the end of their days, and I said that was not going to happen to me. I ask you not to break a promise. During my career, I gave back to the state work days, holidays, cut hours. I gave my own time and purchased out of my own pocket when needed in the schools. I ask you, is taking a portion of my hard-earned pension the right way to provide money to schools? You know, I've taught my students that constitutions are what guides us, and we're bound by that. The Supreme Court has ruled that a pension is a contract, and contracts may not be violated. The Oregon Constitution states that if you don't have enough revenue to fund programs, then you must raise taxes to pay for them. This proposal is conflict with the tenets. Furthermore, the Oregon Supreme Court already has deemed it illegal to take away promised benefits from retirees and current school employees. What has changed since 2003? I held up my part for 17 years. I'm asking you to hold up your part so I can still teach on my own time students that we are guided by our Constitution and we are taken care of when we have contributed. Thank you.
Thank you, Betty. Next panel is David Rees, Val Jack, Mark Perlman, and Louise Curran. On deck, Rob Sisk, Anne Montague, and Rosalie Pedroza.
David, do you wish to proceed, please?
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Reeves. I'm president of the American Federation of Teachers Oregon. We represent over 12,000 members across the state. Our members are dedicated to quality education and serving the public good. I'm here to state our opposition to further cuts to the cost of living adjustment for public employees. We shouldn't be relying on hardworking public employees for further revenue for the state. This is not sustainable. We're talking about permanent cuts that will have drastic effects for a very, very, very long time. Tim previously talked about the sacrifices public employees have made in these tough times. Pay cuts, layoffs, furloughs, things like that. And tough times do call for shared sacrifice. However, it's only public employees are the ones being asked to make a sacrifice in this case. The revenue being raised, it's far outweighed by the cuts to pension funds. In fact, just a report released by the Oregon Center for Public Policy showing the pass-through subsidy for owners of S corporations in one of the revenue bills benefits the top 1% far, far more than anyone else in the state, the 1% of the wealthy. We're not talking about a balanced package here. It's all on the backs of public employees. It's not sustainable. If this were a large Wall Street firm, we'd be talking about raiding pension funds. And it's something my state should not be doing. So I just ask you to consider these are permanent cuts. They're affecting anybody even starting employment nowadays. When you're talking about, inflation's usually 2, 3%. I know it's real low now, but when it returns to those historic levels, this is going to erode people's buying powers and erode what little pension they're earning. So I urge you not to support it, not to continue balancing the budget on the backs of hardworking Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you. Val, would you proceed, please?
Thank you for the opportunity to address you, chairs and members of the committee. My name is Val Jack. I'm president of AFT Oregon Retirees. We are statewide made up of 2,000-plus AFT retirees in Oregon. Most work in public schools, community colleges, universities, and all have been affected by changes to their PERS pensions. According to the Oregonian, PERS retirees are receiving huge pensions paid by the taxpayers. However, most of the people I represent do not receive large pensions, and in most cases, they paid into the fund. We were promised we would receive a pension after retirement with a guaranteed COLA. Nobody mentioned the state might break that contract and things could change. Many of us have already seen those changes. The economic collapse, which was caused by bad behaving and crooked investment banks and others who abused our financial system, resulted in unprecedented losses to PERS and everybody else's investments. And this loss does pose a significant financial challenge to the state. But should the state make it up by taking away from retirees, many of whom were the lowest paid employees in our schools? There are many special needs children, and classified employees work with those children. They changed diapers on young children and adult-sized young people. They fed them. They cleaned up after them. They cooked the lunches. They fed them. They cleaned the bathrooms. They rode the bus with unruly boys and girls, and they did it with love and compassion. But where's the compassion for these individuals now? Many retirees are living at or just above the poverty level with their PERS pension. My understanding of the proposed COLA changes is that everyone will lose money by these changes. However, our costs are not going to reduce. They're going to go up, as David said, with the cost of living. Retirees do spend most of their money. They aren't saving to buy a house, pay for kids' college, or their own retirement, although they're often helping out their children or their grandchildren. They're contributing to the local economy, helping to keep it healthy, further reducing the COLA.
I have to ask you to please.
Okay.
Thank you.
I look at this as a contract violation.
Thank you for your testimony. Louise, so would you like to go next, please?
Thank you, committee chairs and committee. I'm asking you today not to make any additional cuts to PERS benefits. Oregon working families and public employees deserve better. As a recent PERS retiree, a 22-year secretary with Portland Public Schools, my PERS benefit is not extraordinary. After deducting my contribution to my Medicare supplement and my dental insurance, my net PERS benefit is $908 a month. I work serving the public, expecting a reasonable retirement benefit after foregoing raises. I believe that our legislature should not take away those benefits that were part of contracts made in good faith. As a retiree with a small pension as well as Social Security, I can afford to pay my property taxes. I can stay in my own home. I can pay for my insurance. I can also contribute as a consumer, buying groceries, clothes, and paying for services that benefit other Oregonians. As a widow, I can afford to be independent and not be a burden on my adult son. It is unfair to balance the budget on the backs of Oregon public employees, employee retirees, and future retirees. Instead, instead, we should be focusing on finding new revenue to give additional support to schools, post-secondary institutions, and other vital programs. Funding our public schools should not be reliant on public servants who provide services to our students. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you. Mark, would you like to go now, please?
Good afternoon. I'm Mark Perlman. I'm a professor of philosophy at Western Oregon University and president of the faculty union there. And I'm here on behalf of my members to say that, of course, as educators, we're in favor of putting money into education, which has been shamefully underfunded, but not this way, not taking money away from the pensions of current, past, and future educators and looking at them as a source of revenue. I hear a lot of politicians talk about the need to fix PERS, like it was some kind of thing, like a motor that needs a tune-up. It's not a thing. It's people, people who have worked for the state of Oregon, who have given service, have worked for salaries that are far below market value. If they were in private industry, they wouldn't have stood for such salaries. And they did that on one condition, that they would have a secure retirement, because they weren't making enough money to put money away for retirement. And we heard earlier today there's this term they use, unfunded actuarial liability. Now, I know this is accountant speak, but I think we object to having retired state workers and their pensions referred to as liabilities. I would recommend that we call it unfunded moral obligations, or how about unfunded social responsibilities? And these are people who are owed this money that they were promised. It's not an extravagance. They earned it. And this business of calling these things COLAs, I don't understand how you can call something that doesn't adjust for the cost of living a cost of living adjustment. It has to, if you're going to call it a COLA, then it needs to adjust for the cost of living. You know, I'm a philosopher. I teach ethics on a regular basis, but you don't need to be an ethics professor to understand that when you make a promise, you're morally obligated to fulfill your promise, and this measure would be a violation of that promise.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Our next panel, I hope I can do this right, Rob Sisk and Montague, could be wrong, Rosalie Pedroza. So I think we'll go with those three, Craig Monahan and Mary Botkin, Maureen Barnhart and Tony Crawford on deck, but I'm going to go with, excuse me. So here we go. How about Rob? You want to start, please?
Yeah. Co-chair Kotek, co-chair Courtney. For the record, I am Rob Sisk, president of SEIU 503 OPEU. It's here we go again. You know the routine. Time to go after those who have given lives of dedicated public service and accepted lower wages in exchange for a promise of security when they are past their working years and now dependent of that promise for enough income to get by. And it's here we go again. It takes three-fifths majority to go after the rich and powerful, the corporations and ultra-rich who don't pay their fair share, but it takes a 50 plus one to go after the powerless and vulnerable, those who have worked hard and played by the rules, like our PERS retirees did. I just heard the governor repeat something similar to what he said at the Portland City Club in March in regards to PERS retirees. I know they earned it, I know they deserve it, but I need the money. There is a big disconnect here, as if you acknowledge your wrongdoing, it's okay to do it. So I guess this makes bank robbing okay as long as the robber says, hey, by the way, I know this is wrong. Give me your money. The governor also said this is about real people. Real people are very much low-wage retirees, like custodians, clerical workers, groundskeepers, maintenance people, etc. They are people who have mapped out a modest retirement based on a promise, and most likely cannot go back and regain that secure future when that promise is broken. I was just pulled out by one of our retirees and says, you know, if this goes through, I'm going to be compromised on being able to buy tires, my food budget, my pharmaceuticals, my rent. At a time when more and more seniors are retiring into poverty, this trade-off, ripping off low-wage retirees for a deal that purports to be far better than what it will deliver, is not what Oregon needs, and it violates Oregon values. Going after PERS retirees by breaking promises is not only wrong, it's morally wrong. but it seems like the more PERS is whittled away, the more we remove ourselves from this realization.
Ann, would you like to give your testimony, please?
I'm the president of the statewide local of SEIU, and I have to smile at the term grand bargain, which is an imitation of the term used on the federal level for imposing austerity, squeezing working people and making
us
pay.
Excuse me, could you just say your name, please?
Who you are.
Ann Montague.
Thank you very much. Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead, please.
Squeezing working people and making us pay for the financial crisis we did not create. Part of the federal grand bargain was at one point a bipartisan agreement for a tax on Social Security by inflecting the CPI, chain CPI, just like you have attacked PERS recipients once and are about to come back for a second whack. A lot of people right now are remembering the last special session. They remember that Phil Knight wrote up the legislation to enshrine his special track treatment tax breaks. We remember, and we were reminded yesterday as Phil Knight announced he is giving away $500 million. Thank goodness for those tax breaks from the legislature. We remember. And we are the ones thinking about public trust. We spend our whole working lives protecting the public trust. It is our job. And in retirement, we see that trust broken. In my work, that trust would be broken if I used my position as a case manager to deny benefits due to a client, just like when you passed SB 822 and if you pass further cuts on Monday. Another example is if I use money that was meant for one purpose and use it for another, that is a violation of public trust, and it might have been a felony. That is also what happened when you passed SB 822. And what happens when you break a trust? The relationship is broken, and that trust has been broken once already this year with the public retirees, both by denying benefits due and taking money which was held in trust for one purpose and planned to give it for another, instead of going after those who can give away $500 million with a blink of their eye.
Rosalie, would you like to testify now, please?
Rosalie Pedroza, retiree. I'm not going to mince any words. I'm mad. I'm mad that the voters of the state voted for annual sessions, and yet with only 4 months until the regular session, you have chosen to have a second special session. The first one gave special tax breaks to a multi-billion-dollar corporation, and now you want to balance the budget on my back by cutting my cost of living increase. I'm mad because during the 24 years I worked for the people of Oregon, you have balanced the budget on my back with pay freezes, pay cuts, and 32 furlough days, and cut my pension as a result. And you cut my pension in 2003 when you changed me from my retirement plan to a 401k type retirement plan. This is my reality. When I retired in June 2011, I received about $800 a month in pension after paying $527 in health care. In 2012, my COLA raised me up to $827, not even the equivalent of one tank of gas. In January, my health insurance rose to $570 and my check to $787. In July of this year, I came back to $800. I can almost guarantee that my health insurance will again increase in January, leaving me with even less. Yes, I am mad as I try to make ends meet as my pension dwindles until I will probably qualify for the state services my agency issued when I was working. Please vote no on this insane proposal. Thank you.
Thank you.
I could add some of your time.
Our next panel would be Greg Monahan, Mary Botkin, Tony Crawford, and how about Dave Bolton coming forward, please? And the panel to follow would be Sandra Stalin, Ryan Delishman, and Desmir Grieve. Is it? Dagmar Grieve. So that'll follow this group. So there should be four. Okay, so how about Greg? Would you like to proceed, please?
That's me.
Okay, thank you.
Co-Chair Courtney, members of the committee, my name is Greg Monahan. I'm here representing faculty members across the state through the Association of Oregon Faculties. 2 minutes. Let's make this short. For 27 years, I kept a contract with my students. I did my job, showed up for class, graded papers, advised, cajoled, sympathized with, and graduated a lot of Oregonians. And when I gave a student a grade, I didn't turn around later and change that grade so that the grade distribution of my classes would look better. I had entered into a contract with that student. She would get the grade she earned regardless. When I was eligible, I retired, and naively I expected the state of Oregon to keep its side of the contract. I thought that because I had worked hard and long for the state, because I had been professional, ethical, and moral, that the state, in the person of its lawfully elected representatives and its governor, would be professional, ethical, and moral, too. And then came Senate Bill 822. After it passed, we heard all kinds of sympathetic words from Democrats in particular about how this wouldn't happen again. PERS was done. No more cuts. But apparently, those who said that were not telling the truth. The smaller COLAs from 822 weren't small enough. They needed to be tiny, microscopic. So my question for you is a very simple one. When the state of Oregon and I signed that contract 27 years ago, was the state telling me the truth because I wasn't lying to the state? Will you keep your word? Next Tuesday, this great building celebrates its 75th birthday. Don't bring shame on it by betraying the countless employees who have worked and still work to keep the great state it symbolizes working. Thank you.
Thank you. Mary Botkin, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Mary Botkin with AFSCME Council 75. You all know how I feel about this bill. I don't like it any better than any of the rest of the bills you've done. But I want to talk about one specific area because it doesn't really affect my members. It doesn't affect me. And that would be the legislative piece. Taking legislators out of PERS, that sounds good. It makes a great headline. But let's talk about who it would have taken out. Let me just list some names. Stafford Hansel, Vic Attia, Mark Hatfield, the Roberts family, starting with Betty moving to Frank, Barbara and Wendy. How about L.B. Day, Hardy Myers and Wally Carson? All of those individuals, the great spokesmen and women of Oregon who served in this chamber and went on to greater things, would no longer be members of PERS. Why would they give up a lucrative career in the private sector to come be the future statesman of Oregon? I think this bill closes the doors for anybody in the future who really wants to matter and make a difference in Oregon, and I think you ought to think about that. Headlines don't make statesmen. Careers do. And these are the people who made a difference in our state. And there are people coming up behind you and behind me who also will make a difference that may not enter this system because of this. So think about it as you look at this. Thank you.
Tony Crawford, please.
Thank you. Co-Chair Courtney, Co-Chair Kotek, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tony Crawford. I'm a middle school teacher who has taught in the Canby School District for 33 years. And I'm also the Vice President of the Oregon Education Association. I am here today representing the 42,000 members of OEA and to share our concerns with the current legislative concepts around the changes to the public employee retirement system and their singular impact on public employees. More specifically, I'm here to ask you to look at solutions that will truly make an impact on Oregon's future by asking everyone to pay their fair share to fund our schools and other vital services. I must point out that public pensions are not the equivalent of new revenue. Along with our fellow frontline workers, educators have already sacrificed more than $800 million of their hard-earned retirement to pay for schools and other vital services this biennium. As one of our teachers from Hillsboro put it to me a few nights ago, I feel like I'm being punished in order to decrease my class size. Quite bluntly, we cannot continue to balance our budgets and reduce our class size entirely on the backs of public employees. We need to ensure that everyone pays their fair share, and the package in front of you simply doesn't add up. Once again, corporations are getting a pass, and our students are being shortchanged. These bills targeting educators, seniors, and low-wage workers that you are currently debating certainly don't meet the standard of fairness. Equally important, they do not meet the responsibility to pass bills that are constitutionally sound. I urge you to vote no on breaking promises made to tens of thousands of hardworking Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you. Dave Bolton, Sandra Stalen, and Brian Dalschmidt here. And might as well bring up, is it Dagmar Grieve? Dagmar Grieve, please, if she wants to come up. Dagmar, do you want to take over? Yeah, so I just forget right now.
So, for the record, my name is Dave Bolton. I'm president of Local 440 SEIU for DCBS, and my comments don't reflect the insurance division or any of the actuarial work that we do there. But I wanted to take a look at the latest from PERS. Let's take a look at the real figures for a second and look at how come we always hear people quoting the unfunded liability without the side accounts. You know, last time I checked, bonds were at real life assets.
Step back just a little bit, Dave.
Am I blowing you out?
No, you're just a little close to the mic. You're getting fuzzy. Just
oh, okay. Little,
yeah, there
thank you. I hope that doesn't take away
no,
from
we'll
my
give you that
few seconds per my years of service. Anyway, so getting to this, I just like, you know, for once, somebody actually to tell the truth on these kind of things. And look at the funded status of 87%. You know, last time I checked, it wasn't a real crisis if I had 87% or even 80% of my gas in my tank. It wasn't a crisis that I had to deal with. And over the years, ever since I worked at the state, they've been above 80% funding. So where do we hear about how PERS, actually Paul Clary and his staff, and some of them are underneath our building, you've done a great job. Who wouldn't want to be part of this pension plan? Everybody should be have a pension like this. But again, all we hear is this kind of stuff, and I think it's just unbelievable that, again, the state employees who have sacrificed, and we've had three rounds of layoffs, even in a non-general fund agency, that my members have to, you know, again, that's the only place. And meanwhile, you know, the tax situation in the state, we have the lowest corporate tax rate coming in. And by the way, I hope somebody can explain to me, where are the jobs? We may not have any money for the state, but where are the jobs that were promised? There's no jobs that are promised. Again, it's cutting tax corporate taxes, and we don't get any jobs, and the state employees get screwed. That's a great deal. Thank you.
Senator Courtney, Representative Kotek, my name is Sandra Stalen. I live in Salem. I'm a retired secretary who started work later in life after a divorce at State Forestry and later OSU. I am 67, too old to redo my retirement planning. I get a PERS pension of $628 a month or $7,536 a year. My total income also includes Social Security and a little alimony, for a grand total of $19,600 a year. I would like my segment of the PERS population to be considered in this bill. I don't see it there now. Please don't cut my 2% cost of living increase. Every year, the increases in my Medicare Plan B premium, my Medicare Advantage premium, and medical copays all total more than both my PERS and Social Security COLAs combined. Rent and groceries also increase each year. Costs for my 1995 van also increase. I do not qualify for food stamps or housing or medical cost aid. Cutting the 2% COLA to 1.5% is very much a big cumulative effect over time, affecting me negatively. Over the next 30 years, it means two fewer hearing aid upgrades, less dental work, and not getting new eyeglass prescriptions. It means putting off car repairs, moving to a less safe neighborhood. In 20 years, I would receive $7,678 less for my health needs if you cut my PERS COLA. I had planned to work longer, but I injured my right hip in 2008 and could no longer stand it as a pharmacy clerk. Then the recession hit. I now have hearing loss due to the removal of a small glomus tympanicum pulsing tumor inside my left ear in 2012. But I must pay off dental bills before I can save for my first hearing aid. The 2% COLA cut affects me cumulatively to a greater degree. Thank you.
Thank you. All right.
For the record, Brian DeLashman, I represent the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Oregon Nurses Association, the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, and the Oregon State Police Officers, your troopers. I'm going to come at it from just a slightly different angle. There was a handout that was passed to you, and I think it's been alluded to a couple of times, COLA versus really what cost of living is. And that's what I was attempting to demonstrate here. If you look at the first page of this, it actually shows what the average retiree at 30 years is, $2,374. But the real important piece that I wanted to pinpoint was in a communication that I had with PERS about what the impact of actual inflation is versus what the impact of COLA was over time. As you can see, as I highlighted, that for retiree that retired, and I'm looking back history as to what's going to happen to the future, somebody that retired about 30 years ago, their buying power right now is about 76% of what it was in the retired. This is not 76% of their final average salary. This is 76% of what their buying power when they retired is. So I think over time, obviously everybody says, well, you can give up a 0.25% now, it's not a big deal. But when you look at long term, what you're really talking about, it compounds very quickly. As Mr. Clary has indicated, everybody's given up a little bit and it's big dollars. But for the individual, it really does accumulate. The other point I wanted to make was, in the last two pages, is that historically the legislature's made a commitment to actually keep up with the cost of living by giving ad hoc adjustments. Instead of cutting the COLA, they've actually said, listen, you've lost part of your ability to buying power, so we're going to give you ad hoc adjustments. We're going in a totally different direction now, and I think it needed to be brought to your attention that 20, 10, 20, 30 years down the road, we're going to have some people, as we do now, that are in very dire straits because of these cuts. Thank you.
Thank you. And then Dagmar, I believe. Save the best for last.
And I have just up next after that, we have Marcia Kelly, Steve Burton, and Linda Bergen, and Bob Livingston. But Dagmar, you go ahead.
For the record, my name is Dagmar Grieve, and I'm a retiree under PERS. I worked for over 31 years for PERS, and after listening to everybody today, I feel pretty rich. My retirement started at about $3,300 a month. Now I'm up to about $3,400 a month, and after taxes and such, I'm making $29,000. Before I retired, I was making almost $4,000 a month. When I'd go to those PERS classes, unless you ask and know what you're asking for, you're not going to find out anything. So now I know a lot more after 7 years. Part of the thing with PERS is that maybe they aren't looking at it right. Forget the COLA, because you take it out in taxes from us. You know, if I see 30-some dollars and I look at it and I thought, what a surprise. But if you're not making anything, it isn't going to make any difference. And when they look at the top 3 years of a person working, they're probably looking at also how much overtime you've collected too. So some of these people that get a lot of overtime, of course their top 3 years are going to be a lot higher. So it's like they're getting double bennies for what they've done for the past years. If they just took the base pay, then it would probably be a more equal playing ground for everybody. But until they do that, until they stop paying some of these managers exuberant amounts like $171,000 a year, I can't even imagine what those people do with their money. It's just crazy. And I know some of them. And I look at them and I say, I don't see my money's worth in that person. And that's probably half the reason why the private sector is so upset with us, thinking that we're a bunch of parasites just feeding off of everybody. You got to remember, Oregon is based for their government on all the bad stuff that people do anymore. Corrections, state police, OYA, it's all based on people doing wrong. Thank you.
Thank you, Dagmar. And rounding off LC1 and LC2 testimony, Marcia Kelly, Steve Burton, Linda Bergen, and Bob Livingston. Is there anyone else
specifically here to testify on LC 1 and 2. If you're in one of the overflow rooms, could you come to the back of hearing room A? We'll make sure you get in for this particular portion. Thank you.
Chair Courtney and Chair Kotek, my name is Marcia Kelly. I'm the public policy advocate for the American Association of University Women. We have about 10,000, we have about 2,000 members in the state, and I think that 50 to 60% of them are going to be affected by this bill because we have a lot of school teachers who have labored long and hard. Historically, I'm concerned about the cuts in the COLA. Historically, we've never been below 2% unless you're a history buff and go back to the 1930s. And you know what the 30s were like to live. The current 2010-2012 is 2.29 for inflation, and it's projected over the decade to be 3.22 for the decade that we're in right now. I see no indexing for the 20,000, so it wouldn't keep people up at all. I don't see any new provisions to say cap how much you will pay retirement on, like at $250,000 a year for future retirees, instead of only looking at current retirees and current employees. And I also see there's no connect with what we do with our money in the other end of the building. Take a look at the Oregon business website, Business Oregon, and see how much money we're giving away to businesses. And are we correlating that money with actual real jobs? Because the money that we're talking about taking away are real jobs that real people did for the state of Oregon. I've spent 12 years in the building fighting to get the percentage of working for the state, or the percentage of money coming into the state, to get back up to the level where it's not only on the backs of citizens and our state employees, but it's also a participation with the businesses. And it's gone down greatly since the 1980s. Thank you.
Thank you, Marcia.
Co-chairs and committee members, I'm Steve Burton. I have worked over 29 and a half years as a state employee, permanent state employee, and also worked more before that as a temp. My state salary studies show that I have been paid less than the private industry, which is only partially offset by the benefits that we receive. I believe that the 7.75% would lose out in court if passed, but it would we could lose a lot of good employees that would retire now to avoid falling into that. Giving more time to implement the changes could give some of the working people more time to retire. Too little time given for many people eligible to retire and to plan and get it done, they will continue to work at higher salaries. Extending the implementation period would allow more eligible people to decide and get it done, allow more new lower-cost employees to be hired, saving more. Existing employees have high work standards, which work hard and get extra work done. Forcing their retirement would result in losing good employees. Kept working for many people have kept working for the state because of the 8% fixed return, and taking it away would be unfair for why they were there. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Hi, I'm Linda Bergen. I'm past president for SEIU 503 and an almost 29-year state employee in three different state agencies. I just have a couple of points that I want to bring to your attention. One of them is about a year ago, we entertained the author of a book called Retirement Heist, about how corporations have raided pension funds for their workers. And I want to know how it's better for the state of Oregon to do the same thing. Aren't we really doing the same thing? It does take a two-thirds majority to raise taxes, but only one more than half, or a simple majority, for us to raid the pension fund of our state workers. The 2000 crash was not our fault. We know that we can get revenue by going after those who did cause it, the big banks and corporations. We've had some success. Treasurer Wheeler and the Attorney General's office has had some success in recovering some of those funds. And we think that we need to have a stronger effort at going after that money. Another point is about shared sacrifice. How is it shared sacrifice to only take from retired public employees? This is unfair to all public employees. I worked for an analyst at the Oregon Department of Education for many years, and what I would like to see is that we closely consider going over the department's budget. I have some ideas about how that could be done. I've worked in three other agencies, and I can tell you that they are definitely top-heavy in administration. I have grandchildren that are currently in the Salem-Keizer schools, and I'm quite shocked to know that they are no longer assigned books. If they need a book, they can check a book out at the library at the school, but children are no longer assigned books. They're expected to read everything online, even a 300-page document, which is hard for me to do. I don't like to read a document more than 10 pages online. Anyway, thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you, Linda. And Bob?
Madam Speaker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Livingston. I have the privilege and honor of representing the Oregon State Firefighters Council, and I also have the honor and privilege for over two decades being a firefighter here in Salem and actually supporting this community and responding to emergencies at the Capitol. My testimony for today is specific to the Oregon State Firefighters Council, and really briefly, I want to speak specifically to LC2. While that bill has certainly been deemed as the PERS optics bill, I noted that Mr. Cleary didn't spend a lot of great deal of time about any cost savings on that bill, because I don't believe there is a lot. There are unintended consequences if you don't get that right. And let me give you an example. Formerly, I was on the DPSST board that dealt with criminal disqualifiers for public safety officers in Oregon. It took us over a year in order to address those types of situations. Most of you were here in 2003. It took us two sessions after 2003 is when we did the PERS reforms to kind of undo some of those unintended consequences. So as you move forward on that particular package, I would strongly encourage you to make sure your staff is looking at that closely, working with the attorneys and others to get that right. I think most of you will be maybe not surprised, but I'm going to take a little bit different tack than some of the people. I appreciate their testimony today, and it would be easy for my organization to do what would be politically expedient and easy, and that would be to simply say no. But that's not who we are. That's not who we represent as firefighters. One of the things as firefighters is when, you know, most people are running out, we're running in. And I can give you a couple examples. And those examples are, you know, I've had to make decisions over the two decades as a firefighter on, you know, pulling dead kids out in order to get to live kids. I've had to tell people that their loved one has passed away. We've had to make difficult decisions. And a decision that we're going to make is one to say to you that while we can be emotional and say no to this, we do have an opportunity as Oregonians to come together, the legislature does, to move forward, to try to finally resolve some of these issues. And because of that, we would strongly encourage you to do leadership, and that is sometimes do the difficult thing, and that is to move forward, do your best, and continue to try to resolve this and support this package. And let's do what's right, not only for firefighters, but for all Oregonians. And I think you can do it, and you're going to have the support of the firefighters. Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you all. That is that concludes the folks who have signed up specifically to LC 1 and 2 on the PERS bills. And colleagues, I'd like to recommend we take a 10-minute break. We will reconvene at 4:20 and continue with the conversation about LC 5 and the formerly known as Senate Bill 633. 10-minute recess.
Colleagues, the committee will come back to order. Thank you. Sorry that was a slightly longer break than anticipated. I really do appreciate the patience of the folks who come to testify on LC5. We will open up public testimony. I'm going to open the public hearing on LC5. I want to apologize, however, we don't have a draft online or a draft to share, but I think it's clear that what has been committed to from the framework of the legislative leadership is Senate Bill 633, which many people here, I'm sure, are very familiar with a change, an addition to that bill that would allow for the Jackson County ballot that has been approved and cleared for the May 2014 ballot to continue to go through. I don't have language to share with you or language online. We'll get that as soon as we can. But we don't want to make you wait for that because there are a lot of people here to testify. So we're going to go forward with testimony on that general concept. And with that, I'd like to call up, we have some county commissioners here who have business tonight and will need to leave shortly. So if I could have Gil Riddell, from the Association of Oregon Counties, and then Commissioner Mary Stern and Commissioner Greg Pope join us.
Madam Chair, Greg Pope had to leave, so
My apologies. Thank you. And then we'll start off with this group, and then, again, same rules apply, 2 minutes.
Yes.
And if you have written testimony, please submit it on deck. Barry Bouchot, Scott Setnicker, and Helly Rudenklau.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. Before I introduce Mary Stern, our AOC president, I wanted to mention that we have submitted, AOC has submitted electronically written comments on each of the other LCs. We especially appreciate, we support the whole package. We especially appreciate the $20 million for mental health services. With that, we're here to address LC5 only, better known as Senate Bill 633. With me is Mary Stern, Yamhill County Commissioner, who is the president of AOC.
All right. Thank you so much, Madam Chair and Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. I really appreciate the work that you have done on behalf of the citizens of Oregon this past session, and especially on behalf of the counties that are in fiscal crisis. This special session also has the potential to provide for further assistance, and for that we're very grateful. AOC supports LC5 because counties do not have the expertise, the staff, or the money to oversee and enforce programs that restrict any type of seeds or agriculture. We believe this issue is best left to the Department of Agriculture with the help of OSU Extension Service. I know it's unusual for counties to come to you advocating against local control. It probably has never happened before, but that we are here today for that because it is very important to us. In addition to the problems that local regulations would cause local jurisdictions, it would be a nightmare for farmers, and I'm sure you'll hear more about that today. But I especially think of the farmers in Yamhill County who own property and manage properties in adjacent counties and would have to worry about cross-pollination and cross-regulations, and it would be so difficult for them, as well as difficult for our staff to oversee if we could find an expert to hire to be able to do that. If you consider what has happened last summer, I think it puts everything into perspective with the GMO in the wheat in eastern Oregon. Federal and state investigators interviewed 270 Pacific Northwest growers and studied the issue intently. After 4 months, they still didn't have any answers as to how this happened. How on earth would little but mighty Gillam County have been able to deal with that issue? The bill before you reserves to the state the regulation of agricultural seeds as well as flower and nursery stock seeds and seed byproducts. As the governor said, this bill is about governance. It's not about Monsanto. It's not about GMOs. It's not about organic farms. Plain and simple, the counties are in no position to regulate agricultural seeds and their byproducts. And I do want to make a note about Blue Oregon, which I visit often, and I posted recently on their site. They have a box that says, allow cities and counties to regulate GMOs. Stop the Oregon Monsanto Protection Act. Please do not allow cities and counties to provide this regulation. We can't do it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Commissioner Stern. Thank you.
Representative Frederick, we'll bring you up after this panel if you'd like to have a couple minutes on this particular topic. And we might have legislative council come back in a bit, but we wanted to get started on the public testimony.
My name is Barry Bichu. My wife and I raise a variety of vegetables, fruits, flowers, and pumpkins for our local community. I also serve as president of the Oregon Farm Bureau. Oregon Farm Bureau supports the entire package of bills, but I'm going to focus my comments on the seed preemption legislative concept. I appreciated the governor's comments earlier today regarding the importance of agriculture. This legislation prevents a patchwork of different county and municipality regulations on agricultural seed. Farms do not stop at county or city limits. Many family farms across Oregon grow crops in multiple counties. These farms are managed as a whole. Crops are rotated between fields based on many factors, and politically drawn lines would prohibit farmers from properly managing their operations. Farms like mine are local, but the agricultural industry are a part of the statewide. Many farmers serve national and even international markets. Genetic modification is at issue here in many people's minds. It's not new in agriculture. Modern biotechnology is just the latest in a long progression aimed at improving plants and animals for the benefit of mankind. Agricultural products derived from modern biotech are the most thoroughly reviewed and strictly regulated in history. The overwhelming scientific consensus on the safety of modern biotechnology is unequivocal. The U.S. government, the World Health Organization, the American Medical Association, the National Academy of Science, and the European Union Commission study all agree that food derived from biotechnology is as safe as any other food. The Obama administration has embraced the importance of diversity in agriculture. The president himself has advocated for biotechnology as an important component of our food supply. Secretary Vilsack appointed me along with 22 other people to serve on a committee to discuss biotechnology and agriculture in the 21st century. One of our main charges was framing the importance of coexistence of GE crops, non-GE crops, and identity preserve. The committee endorsed as a whole the importance of all forms of agriculture working together. Coexistence works. Organic papaya growers use GM papaya surrounding their fields to stop ring spot virus coming in papayas. My farm is diverse. My neighbors, large and small, work together and work collaboratively. We have a unique and diverse agricultural economy. We should be embracing our differences, not excluding them. I hope the legislature passes this legislation to preserve the showpiece of agriculture that my members and I are so incredibly proud of. Thank you.
Thank you, Barry.
Thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Haley Rattenclaw. My husband, Bruce, and I are farmers. We operate a family farm of around 1,000 acres, and some of it is in Yamhill County and some of it is in Polk County. My job on the farm is twofold. I help out with field work, which I really enjoy, but mostly I'm responsible for the office and making sure that we follow all the regulations that we're supposed to. Having extra regulations imposed on us, as always, makes my job more difficult. We just finished the process of trying to decide which crops to go in which fields for the coming year. We tried to come up with a mix of crops that will make us the most money while making sense economically. Some of the most profitable crops we grow are specialty seeds, including sugar beet seed and radish seed. These crops require a certain isolation distance so pollen cannot cross-contaminate the seed lines. We have rental ground, which is miles apart from each other. It's a pain when it comes to moving equipment around, but it allows us to grow specialty seeds, more of it, because we have the required isolation distance. This system is not set up by Oregon law, but it's something that all specialty seed growers voluntarily follow. Having county-specific regulations would interfere with this system. However, I'm mainly concerned where county-by-county legislation would lead to. The process of setting arbitrary limits at the local level is not a good precedent. If we're talking about genetically modified crops, the issues involved are very scientifically complex. I therefore hope we can leave regulations to the people we've already designated to do that, the Oregon Department of Agriculture. They have the experts who are in the best position to deal with this. I spend a lot of time trying to educate people about agriculture. We have some of the signs, crop ID signs you guys maybe have seen along the highways. We grow sugar beet seed, which is a genetically modified crop. We've decided not to put a sign out on the highway. You probably heard about the vandalism in Southern Oregon this year. I'm very sad that this is happening. And I think one of the issues here is not to put up some more of these local fights that just pit agriculture against each other, which I think would be very sad to see. So, thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Scott Setnicker. I'm a graduate of Oregon State University in 2005 with a degree in crop science. I farm with my dad on our family farm in Polk County in Yamhill County. We farm around 5,500 acres. We grow a variety of crops, which include grass seed, peppermint, spearmint, hazelnuts, processed sweet corn, field corn for silage, field corn for grain, as well as sweet corn. And I also have 45 acres of organic production that we use to grow sweet corn on. Well, let me step back a little bit. I want to talk mostly about field corn. Field corn production on our farm is largely all GMO production. We farm approximately 600 to 700 acres annually, mostly Roundup Ready and insect-traited GMO varieties. Most of our field corn is grown in Polk County, but our drying and storage facility is in Yamhill County, so make it very difficult, as well as some of our corn is grown in Yamhill County as well. In the United States, there's 90 million acres of field corn produced, and 90% of that field corn is genetically modified. And that's a combination of herbicide-tolerant traits and BT traits. Field corn in Oregon, on my handout I handed out, field corn and grain corn and silage corn is the ninth on the list of farm gate value crops in Oregon at 109 million. And the eighth ranked crop is blueberries, and we're very close to that. So it's a very valuable crop. In agriculture, we're kind of in an arms race with Mother Nature. We're always needing new seeds, new technology, because diseases are always changing, pests are always changing. And so it's really critical that we have that tool in our toolbox. And on my handout, I got a couple other sheets in here. The first sheet's a Pioneer corn seed sheet, and this is what we use to pick out our hybrids. The second sheet is a Mycogen. There are two Mycogens owned by Dow and Pioneers owned by DuPont. And if you look at the Pioneer sheet, I kind of drew on it, but it shows the different day lengths of corn we grow in the Willamette Valley. And if you look on the far right, they don't even offer a conventional hybrid in that range. And the first two, the 72-day and the 74-day, are the varieties that they're now growing in Tillamook County. There's 5,000 acres of corn being grown in Tillamook County. And if this ban were to take place in Tillamook County, the growers would literally have no varieties to plant that are conventional that would fit into that. So I urge you to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Representative, do you want to allow you the opportunity to speak to a different topic? And then if Ivan Maluski and Chris Schreiner would like to join you.
Hi.
And then on deck, we will have Clint Lindsay, Christy Split, and Angela Crowley Cook. Representative, would you like to?
Thank you. I'm State Representative Lou Frederick, District 43, North and Northeast Portland. I really don't know where to start on this in some ways. This is, in my view, dangerous from a governance standpoint, an economic standpoint, and a scientific standpoint. And I can speak to that in a different way. I'm probably the only legislator who has actually genetically engineered organisms in my life. I've done that as a molecular biologist, and I have some knowledge of this from a research standpoint. This bill, in my view, is inspired not by a need to coordinate regulation as it's being sold, but by a desire to eliminate regulation. We should remember that the incident in Jackson County that spurred action there involved a farmer's crops being ruined by illegal action for which he had no recourse. Some of the science is still out regarding GMO crops, but some of it isn't. We know that cross-pollination with existing crops happens and that there are already places in the world where certain plants without genetically engineered genes have been eliminated. That can't be reversed, and this is a massive experiment. The argument that it's just like selective breeding is both wrong and, frankly, insulting. But SB 633 applied to a lot more than GMO crops. The economic devastation wrought worldwide by the intricacies of patent protection of genetically engineered seed cannot be overstated. But the potential for our own heritage seed industry to be ruined is even more immediate. This bill, in my view, has no place in this procedural environment, if it has a place anywhere. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Co-chairs Courtney and Kotek, for the record, Ivan Molesky, director of Friends of Family Farmers based in Molalla, Oregon. I'm also a farmer who raises pork and poultry on 46 acres in Clackamas County. Friends of Family Farmers would like to convey today our opposition to including LC5, a bill that would take away the rights of local communities to protect local food and agriculture through local ordinances. It's bad public policy for Oregon farmers, consumers, and local communities, and should not be included in this complicated and unrelated legislative tax and pension package. And I would like to say that we've circulated a letter and can make sure it's in the testimony from a wide range of groups, including Friends of Family Farmers, Oregon Tilth, who you'll hear from later, Willamette Food and Farm Coalition, Oregon Rural Action, and the Oregon Farmers Market Association, all opposing this legislation and its inclusion in this package. The intent of this bill is to stop community efforts to increase transparency and oversight over genetically engineered crops and foods. It takes away local control, and it does nothing to clarify or create statewide policies in its place. The legislative record shows that the primary groups lobbying behind this bill have been vocal opponents of every piece of legislation that came before the regular session that would have increased transparency and oversight over GE foods and crops. And we believe, and when we've heard and we've done listening sessions with farmers around the state, is there is a desire for more transparency and more oversight. And right now the state's not doing it, and the federal government has frankly dropped the ball. The appearance of GE wheat in eastern Oregon last year, or earlier this year, and GE alfalfa in Washington earlier this month demonstrate that again, the federal and state agencies are not doing their job. GE contamination can negatively affect both organic and conventional farmers, particularly those dependent on foreign and domestic markets where GE-free material is required or expected. And farmers can face serious economic losses. I'm going to jump ahead and say that this bill also has a lot of unintended consequences. If you look at the language, it's very broad. It also applies to products of seed, which includes food, plants, and trees. And so I would say if you're going to consider any amendments to this, and I can't guarantee this would garner our support, but please consider stripping out the provisions that apply to products of seed as well, because I think that you're going to find that the counties here that have spoken up today are going to find a lot of unintended consequences for local ordinances that that may be important to them that they're already enforcing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, committee members. My name is Chris Schreiner. I'm the executive director of Oregon Tilth. We are also here to express our opposition to including LC5 in this package. Oregon Tilth is a nonprofit organization that supports and promotes sustainable and organic agriculture. We are accredited by the USDA to certify organic operations to the federal National Organic Standard, and we certify the majority of the operations here in Oregon. I'll just defer to our written comments on the details of the tremendous growth and success of organic agriculture in Oregon, but we are a leader nationally. And I would want to focus my time today on the fact that really emphasizing that this is bigger than organic agriculture. While I'm here to represent that, I want to emphasize that the risk of contamination from GE crops affects a lot of Oregon agriculture, including producers that are selling to export markets that do not want GE material in sold or provided to their consumers, as well as the special seed industry and identity preserved producers. We have two examples in the last 5 months in our region that really highlight the problems and the lack of effective of what we currently have in terms of controls. The first is the GE wheat discovery in eastern Oregon that led Japan and South Korea to temporarily suspend imports of soft white wheat from the Northwest. And last month up in Washington State, we had an alfalfa producer who was prepared to send a load of hay to a foreign market. The broker had to test that hay for GE, and it tested positive. They lost that sale. In response, the USDA said they were not going to investigate the issue. It was a marketplace issue. It had to be sorted out in the marketplace. It wasn't up for government. So that really leaves producers who want to provide these types of products to their buyers without any recourse or protection for economic losses. That's an indication. Both of those cases indicate the difficulty of controlling and containing GE crops from contaminating neighboring crops, as well as the failure of our federal oversight system. For those reasons, we urge you to oppose this inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Clint Lindsay, Christy Split, and Angela Crowley Cook. And there are, I want to make sure a couple individuals who came a long way get to be heard. Sabrine Siegel and Diane Castillo, you'll be next.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Clint Lindsay. I'm a farmer with Stalford Seed Farms in Tangent, Oregon. We have just under 500 acres in organic crops and roughly 5,500 acres farmed conventionally. We grow a range of grains, beans, and edible seeds. We both export grains overseas and sell a large amount of organic staple foods locally and regionally. I'm here today to urge the legislature to vote no on this package, which includes SB 633. This bill did not have the support to pass fairly in the legislature during the regular session. It does not enjoy broad support in the public now. In fact, there is widespread opposition to this bill in the public. This is seen as a backdoor attempt to push through undemocratic and ill-conceived legislation. It is presented in such a way that some legislators may find it difficult to vote no on this bill after the governor's promise to veto them all if a single piece does not make it through. Many of your constituents will be very upset to learn that their democratic right to decide seed and food policy in their community has been given up as a political bargaining chip. The governor spoke of aiming for a state policy on seed oversight to be debated during the 2015 session. There most certainly should be debate at the state level for good seed and food system policy, but not after stripping counties and local communities of their ability to protect their unique food sheds. Those of us whose businesses will be impacted by the proliferation of patented seeds do not have the luxury of waiting for effective state oversight to happen. We can't rely on the state and federal governments to adequately protect us at this time, and if this bill passes, we will no longer be able to protect ourselves. Reject this package and any deal which includes legislation that strips us of our right to decide what is best for our community's food systems. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairs Kotek and Courtney, members of the committee, thank you for your time today. For the record, my name is Christy Splitt, and I'm the coordinator for the Oregon Conservation Network, a coalition of 44 groups and growing from Hell's Canyon to the South Coast. We actually have tens of thousands of members if you combine all of the different organization membership together. We pass pro-conservation laws, protect our unique quality of life, and ensure a better Oregon for our children. Each session, the Oregon Conservation Network identifies priorities for a healthy Oregon and major threats to a healthy Oregon. We didn't expect to be here this special session. However, we are, and we have identified both LC5 and any package that includes LC5 as a major threat. I'm glad to see and honored to sit next to an organic farmer and food safety advocates here today to share their concerns. These are the folks who know the issues best. But we also want to echo those concerns, concerns that range from access to international markets for our farmers to the removal of a crucial incentive for agribusiness and chemical companies to help craft a statewide policy around GMO seeds and products. We also worry about unintended consequences that overturn local policies already in place and already enforced at the county and local level. Further, the Oregon Conservation Network feels strongly that the all-too-common practice of trading bills that roll back or prevent environmental protections for votes on unrelated issues must end. To have it happen so obviously and so abruptly means that we have no choice but to stand against any package that includes LC5. Thank you for your careful consideration of this package. We urge you to do all that you can to take LC5, an unrelated and inappropriate bill for a conversation about the budget, off the table.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Angela Crowley Cook. I'm the legislative director at Oregon Environmental Council. And OEC really appreciates your hard work to balance Oregon's budget and find additional funding for our schools. However, achieving these commonly held goals should not rely on the passage of an unrelated bill that threatens the economic viability of Oregon's strong organic industry, takes away citizens' right to know what they eat. Questions of a local government's authority to make decisions about growing and selling food and plants simply do not belong in this debate and in this package. We strongly urge you not to support any package that includes a local preemption bill. There are several reasons why OEC opposes this package, and I'll highlight a few right now. Overall, the bill really puts the cart before the horse in this situation. We don't have any state policies regulating GMOs, and that causes a serious problem. So to take away the right of local communities to make these decisions without an existing statewide policy is a huge problem. In the absence of effective federal or state rules, which, let's be honest, if they are ever enacted at a state level, will take decades to implement going through the rulemaking and the lawsuits. And that's decades of risk for farmers that risk the contamination. A local preemption bill will leave farmers without recourse to protect their crops, potentially resulting in economic loss.
Lastly, second, let's remember that the Oregon Department of Agriculture has previously claimed that it lacks the authority to regulate genetically modified organisms. So the potential solution that the proponents are putting forward, ODA has already said previously in the canola debate that they don't have that authority. So it's very curious that this is being put forward as a solution. Doesn't seem to work out that way. In addition, proponents seem to be talking out of both sides of their mouths on this issue. On the one hand, proposing that we have a statewide regulation and that it's the best solution, while on the other hand, last session, there were several bills that were proposed to have statewide regulation on GMOs, HB 2319 and HB 2736, that would do just that, and they opposed those bills. The measure is very broad. It could preempt existing rules and that regulate the spread of noxious weeds and food safety rules. So finally, to allow the local preemption bill as a bargaining chip is to jeopardize an important Oregon economic contributor, the organic industry, which has experienced double-digit growth for the past decade and ranks fifth in the nation for the number of organic farms. For these reasons, we urge you to vote no on any package that includes a local preemption bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Diane Castillo and Sabrina Siegel. Was there anyone else in the room or in the overflows that wanted to testify that's come from more than 100 miles? 100 miles, yes. I know we have I have people on the list. Are you on?
No, ma'am.
Is there a sign-up sheet, though? Well, if you haven't signed up, please sign up on LC5, and please mark if you are from a little ways away. We're glad you're here. Whoever wants to start first.
Okay. Hi, I'm Diane Castillo, and I really appreciate this time to speak today. I feel if you pass SB 633, the Oregon Monsanto Protection Act, you are saying that this is beneficial for Oregon citizens. Some of the consequences of consuming and growing GMO seeds and foods are allergies, intestinal disorders, cancer, soil vitamin depletion and contamination, cross-pollination, autoimmune diseases, genetics alteration. Our Creator designed a perfect seed and food for our wondrous Pacific body. I pray that we retain the right to label and to grow healthy food free of cross-pollination and toxins. And I also challenge you all, as our elected representatives, there's a couple of awesome YouTube free videos. One's Genetic Roulette and one's called Seeds of Death. And they explain a lot of scientific basis information pertaining to this issue. I'm saddened at the process of bundling this agenda item. I'm disappointed at Mr. Kitzhaber for his earlier comments. I'm asking you to please put our health of Oregon first. Agendas, I feel my husband's involved in politics, I'm involved in, and I enjoy being part of the process of having a voice to represent other people. But this discussion, this agenda items will come and go in this bundled package, and I feel this discussion will impact the masses for future generations. And also, as a dramatic comment, Obama eats organic, Monsanto employees eat organic in their cafeteria. My daughter, who's suffering from health ailments, is prescribed organic, and she's healing, and she's doing a lot better. And she's told if she eats organic completely for another year, she may lose a lot of these problems that she has intestinally and just eating one bite of food and then being in pain all night. And I eat organic also, and I just don't want to eat an organic salad sprayed with pesticides and the stuff Roundup, and that's basically what Monsanto does. So please consider this. This is very important to many of us, and I appreciate your time. Thank you. my name is Sabrina Siegel, and I'm also a mother and an artist, but I volunteer a lot of my time with GMO-Free Oregon just because it's such a distressing, dangerous technology, and the GMO technology, and that it's even in our American food supply is out. It's an outrage, really, and it's highly irresponsible that it's allowed in our state in the first place, when there have been no long-term studies done on health and the environment, and there have been some peer-reviewed studies in Europe that show that there is health damage to animals. And the responsible thing to do, you know, would be like the other 65 other countries do in imposing, they have bans and strict regulation on GMOs, and they're doing the responsible thing and exercising the precautionary principle, because we have no idea, really, the havoc that it's wreaking on our environment. It destroys the soils and the microorganisms in the soils. It creates very harmful food for humans and animals. And just like you have heard, patients are being prescribed organic food because of this. And and the fact that we have GMOs planted in our country, in our state, shows the great influence of the strong biotech and chemical corporations, the influence they have on our government. And these are biotech chemical corporations. They create the seeds to sell their chemicals together. They're not interested in feeding the world or our health or anything like that. And on the point of democracy,
Ms. Siegel, try to wrap up.
Okay, Oregon is a home rule state, and it's our right, and that's how democracy works. That a county could vote on an issue, you know, whether they want to have GMOs grown in their county. And that's how democracy works, by majority vote, right? So thank you so much for your time.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for being here. Could we have Bill Brewer, Rodney Hightower, Brenda Rakitic, and Bill Hoyt? On deck. Nope, you're up. And on deck, we have Lori Ann Bird, Jeannie Harden, and Nancy Baker Croft. Please, go ahead.
Okay, I'm Bill Brewer. I'm the president and CEO of the Oregon Potato Commission, and thank you for your time, and appreciate what you're doing here. So I would like to speak in favor of LC5. One of the main reasons is that I believe that we need to leave the consideration of whether or not GMO should be allowed or not to the scientists and the expertise of the state or the federal government. And by making a decision of limiting future GMOs by county, you don't know what types of restrictions you're actually going to involve at a later date. Right now, in the potato world, there are no GMO potato varieties in the U.S. commercially grown, but there are potatoes that are on the shelf, that there's scientists that are working on GMO varieties. And so I'm not saying that potentially we might get there, but right now there are no commercially grown GMO potatoes. But one of the things that we are working on is there's an invasive species of a nematode that is a quarantine pest, and we're working on a trap crop that tricks this nematode into hatching, and by hatching and then not having the food available, it dies. And right now, this is one of the major concerns of our industry, and hopefully we don't get that in Oregon, but there's potential of it happening. And so anyway, I just urge you to vote in favor of Senate Bill 633, and if there's any questions, I can take them at another time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is Brenda Furkatich, and I'm a third-generation farm out in St. Paul, Oregon. I farmed with my family for the past 7 years, and I'm looking forward to continuing this legacy here in Oregon. We grow wheat, perennial ryegrass, hazelnuts, vegetables, and clover on our 1,000-acre sustainable farm. I would like to thank first the governor for his support of this legislation. I think he worded it very well of why this is so important and why he included it in this package. I'm here today to support this package and would like to address the seed preemption issue specifically. For me as a young farmer, this is a very important issue for me, and it's something that will help in this for my security in knowing that I would be able to farm here in the future. Oregon and the U.S. Department of Agriculture are the only entities with the expertise to regulate agricultural crops. These are funded departments that have the specialists, financial backing, and research abilities to take on this task. I believe that if you start to hand out this important responsibility to smaller and not well-equipped lower levels of government, the expensive science necessary to make workable decisions for Oregon agriculture will go by the wayside. I think that we will be faced with impractical laws on what we can grow and how we can farm based solely on fear and emotion. If we take these issues away from the state and give it to lower levels of government, it would quickly create a nightmare for me as a producer and as a family farmer. I farm along county lines, and I know farmers who farm between counties as well. Can you imagine being regulated on what you can grow in one part of your farm and not on another, let alone trying to control your pollen and keep it on your side of the county line? Oregon agriculture also employs one in every eight workers in this state, so it doesn't just affect family farmers. It also affects manufacturers and distributors who would also face a logistical disaster. In a recent survey done by the National American Farm Bureau Young Farmers and Ranchers, it was shown that the second highest concern for young farmers today was regulations and red tape. And that is something that I'm here to fight for because I think it's important for our future. Thank you.
Thank you.
Co-Chairman Kotek, Co-Chairman Courtney, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Rodney Hightower. I farm in Junction City, Oregon, in Lane County. I'm also the past president of the Oregon Seed Council, and I am to relay a message to you that the Oregon Seed Council endorses the whole package of bills that are before you. But I also appreciate the governor being here earlier today and supporting agriculture and standing up for our right to grow the crops that we need to grow to be profitable. The governor was right that this isn't a GE issue or a biotech issue. This is a regulation issue. Agriculture is already regulated at the state and the federal level. We have 36 counties in the state and over 400 incorporated cities. If each one of those has their own regulations on agriculture, it quickly turns into a big mess. As Brenda said, there's farmers that farm across county lines, and their hands would be tied on what they could grow and where. My farm is lucky. We farm in one county. Sometimes I feel unlucky that it's Lane County. But that's where God put our ground, so we'll live with that. But we grow a variety of crops. We grow grass seed, specialty vegetable seeds, wheat, and yes, genetically engineered sugar beet seed. The sugar beet seed has been a management change, but it's not a problem. It's not a pest. It's not a boogeyman. We're living with it. We're managing it. And it's lowered our costs. It's better for the environment because two applications of Roundup to control the weeds is a lot better than the other chemicals that are also labeled for sugar beet production. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Lane County's not so bad. I have to stand up for my members on that.
Madam Chair, neither is Lynn County.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Hoyt. I'm the legislative chair for the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. We just concluded our quarterly meeting, and the board of directors wanted me to let you know that they voted in favor of the entire package. I'm here to speak specifically on number five. However, the board of directors was very thankful that this package came at the time it did, and they wanted to me to send their support or extend their support to you, and thank you for doing so. As far as Senate Bill 633 is concerned, I testified during the session on it. I think that the Department of Agriculture and the U.S. Department, the Oregon Department of Agriculture, has the tools to deal with this issue. I don't think we should speak at this point to whether or not GMO is good, bad, or indifferent. That's not what we're doing. We're saying that the control from at the state level is much broader than what it would be if it was divided up into 36 different counties. My ranch is I'm five generations in the ranching business. My great-great-grandfather homesteaded our ranch and also Lane County. We ranch in both Douglas and Lane County, and so we would be, and the ranch actually headquarters sets right on the county line. So it would be very difficult for us if the two counties would be, were to disagree on how to handle this situation. The cattle industry today is the number one, commodity in the state of Oregon. It requires heavily on feed. And so in order for us to deal, and feed is very expensive, by the way, and so we really need all the tools in the toolbox, and we really appreciate you taking a look at how this is best done, and I think in the future we'll need to address some of these issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you all for being here. Lori Ann Bird, Jeannie Hardin, and Nancy Baker Croft. And on deck,
it's amazing how many of these farms are
we have Aiden Humphrey, Karen Swift, and Amy Wong. I haven't worked outside.
Hello. Co-chairs and members of the committee, I thank you for this opportunity to present testimony. My name is Lori Ann Bird, and I'm a former farmer and an attorney with the Nonprofit Center for Food Safety. We're here on behalf of our nearly 350,000 members, including thousands in Oregon. LC5 would strip away the right of communities to make locally appropriate decisions about agriculture. The inclusion of this legislation, promoted by out-of-state anti-conservation interests, has no place in this legislative package. CFS has worked with many local entities to craft bills regulating GE crops. Counties throughout our neighboring states of California, Washington, and Hawaii have successfully regulated GE crops without creating the significant regulatory burdens that the other folks have discussed or exposing themselves to any legal challenges. This legislation is a solution in search of a problem that does not exist. None of the legislation that's out there has created any significant problems. Counties seek to regulate GE crops because the truth is that the states and the federal government have failed to do so adequately. This was evidenced this year by the discovery of unapproved experimental GE wheat in eastern Oregon. This finding cost Oregon farmers export markets and caused untold financial losses. GE bentgrass, opposed by many Oregon grass farmers, has now contaminated our national grassland and eastern Oregon and has proven impossible to rein in. In some instances, a single instance of genetic contamination can cost farmers millions of dollars. In addition, counties may seek to regulate GE crops to protect health and the environment. GE crop systems have resulted in a tenfold increase in glyphosate in just 12 years. LC5 would preempt counties from protecting human health and the environment by regulating the cause of these harms. I ask you to withdraw LC5 from this package. It is an inappropriate addition to this legislation, and its overly broad language would cripple local democratic efforts to protect farmers, consumers, and the environment. I thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Jeannie Hardin. I am a licensed school teacher and a small farmer and a Grange member at the Oregon State Grange, and I have complete confidence in this legislative body to reject legislative concept 5, which preempts counties from passing laws at the behest of their citizenry in regards to their own agricultural needs. The governor had pointed out the complexity of agriculture in Oregon, and in fact, ODA has this nice little map that shows six areas of regions in Oregon, different growing areas that all have completely different climates, microclimates, markets, challenges, goals, soil types. And we already have regulations in these regions that differ from place to place. And a lot of them you know about. Canola, you can plant here and you can't plant there. You can burn grass seed here and you can't burn it there. Somehow it's all been going on okay for a long time. We have the pinning system where farmers get to explain where they're going to be planting seed, and this has been well, probably not easy. Over the years, it has been doable. What is not doable is the state regulating agricultural seed. This is only because what I heard directly from Katie Koba during the canola debacle, when she said, we do not, cannot, and I don't know what else not, cannot regulate GMOs. This is about GMOs. This is precisely about Monsanto. Monsanto holds 90% of the patents of GMOs. This is a GMO pro-Monsanto bill, and we would like to preserve our democratic right to use our local governments in the way they were designed to protect our local agriculture. Thank you.
Thank you. And is Nancy here?
Did she have to leave? I don't see her.
Okay. And so our next panel is Aidan Humphrey, Karen Swift, and Amy Wong. And then I have three more after that. I have Tony Castaneda, Diane Carney, and Casey Mume. Is there anyone else signed up for LC5 that I haven't called? If you're interested in testifying, we'll have to get you on the list. So Aidan, are Karen and Amy here? They might be coming from another room. Just go ahead and get started.
Hi, my name is Aidan Humphrey, and I'm from the little tiny town of Lancaster, just north of Junction City. I'm an intern architect. This summer, we got hit with, this summer when the mosquito trucks came out, we were normally able to shut up the house we live in and keep a fairly good air supply. However, there came a point in the summer when the biotech fumes were so strong, it was like breathing inside the inside of a paint can, that I ended up, my wife and I, bundling the kids up, taking them out of the house, putting them in the minivan, and going on a long drive in hopes when we came back the air would be all right to breathe again. There's a certain feeling of powerlessness when my air supply, the quality of my air supply, depends on the decisions made in a lab in a by a multinational corporation far away from me. When the quality of the water in my well depends on people I can't see or talk to, when the food that my children will eat tonight is being impacted by people who are very far distant from me. Conversely, there's a certain power for out-of-state biotech corporations such as Syngenta and Monsanto when they can remove local control and concentrate it for their convenience and easy access at higher and higher levels of government. We've heard farmers here say this needs to be dealt with at the state level, and at the same time saying, you know what, it needs to be dealt with at the federal level and with the international. So it makes it easy for them to control, and it makes it hard for us to access. It strips away our local control of our food supply, and it disenfranchises the people from their own land, from their own food supply. It makes us feel that we have less of a say in our government if you take control further and further away from us. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Karen Swift or Amy Wong? Might have had to leave. And again, I do thank everyone for your patience. It's been a long afternoon. Tony Castaneda, Diane Carney, and Casey Mume. And that will conclude who I have listed for LC5 testimony. Whoever wants to start, just say your name for the record.
My name is Casey Muma, and I'm from Topeka, Kansas. I've come here to speak to you today, and I appreciate the opportunity, because we from the Midwest, we really admire Oregon's agriculture. You have an incredibly diverse agriculture, and it's different in every single part of the state. and it brings in income like no other. It's an incredible machine. LC5 would open the door to regulating it, making broad sweeping rules that force you to choose whether your GMO farmers can make money or your non-GMO farmers can make money, whether your organic farmers can make money, whether your non-organic farmers. You would, as I understand it, the package before you has a lot to do with budget, the budget of the state, your income. I'm no politician. I don't really understand these things, but it seems that to pass this piece of legislation would damage your budget far more than not passing it. And that's really all I have to say to you. Thank you.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, member of the committee. My name is Tony Castaneda. I'm with United Natural Foods, Inc. We're the leading independent national distributor of natural, organic, specialty foods, nutritional supplements, and personal care items in the United States. I specifically work with Oregon colleges, universities, hospitals, restaurants, and food manufacturers, and offering local organic hospitals, non-GMO project certified foods that our families and our children and communities enjoy. Thank you for allowing me the time to talk here, and I'm getting a little choked up.
Fine, Tony, but just sit back just a tad.
Okay. Yeah, there you go. So this is an urgent, pressing matter of concern over the integrity and future of our seeds, food supply, and agricultural heritage. I received a letter that I was asked to read from Food Democracy Now, and this letter, they have, they're going to submit this to Governor Kitzhaber and to the to you and the legislation. Organic seed growers and the trade association, we've received signatures from over 400 family farmers and 19,000 individuals from across the country to this letter. As farmers and free citizens, we believe in the right of self-determination and the consideration of legal protections that are deemed necessary and appropriate for the preservation of our individual farms and communities. This concept represents a fundamental principle of local control. It's for this reason that we urge you to support the right of local county elected officials to create appropriate standards for their communities in the state of Oregon in regards to the regulation, oversight, sale, distribution, and planting of seed. Local economically and ecologically sound community-determined standards are best suited to provide long-term success for family farmers. As such, local elected officials and area farmers and communities must maintain the right to decide their choice of seed and agricultural practices that are best suited for their region as they work to create effective land stewardship and protection of our seed and agricultural heritage. While we recognize the right of states to pass their own laws as they relate to the issues that affect their citizens, food and agriculture within their respective state, the current bill before the Oregon legislature, State Bill 633, regarding the regulation of seed affects all farmers throughout the United States. And indeed, many farmers around the globe, as the majority of betta seeds, chard and beet, for example, originate in the state of Oregon. The bill, State Bill 633, which was recently attached to the budgetary spending bill for the state of Oregon, takes the regulation, sale, and planting of seed out of the hands of local farmers and citizens, where it is best practiced and understood, and grants it exclusively to the state.
Tony, can you wrap it up? If you have something in writing, feel free to submit it in writing, too.
Okay. I'll wrap this up. So organic farmers in Rogue and Willamette Valley have created solutions appropriate and effective providing community protections to localities. We urge Governor Kitzhaber and the members of Oregon State Legislature to oppose State Bill 633 and stand up for the right of Oregon citizens to determine for themselves the appropriate standards by which to protect their local communities and themselves. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Like that. Okay. Well, I'm certainly paired with people of the same like-mindedness. My name is Diane Carney. I'm here today because to share with you my recent turn in medical situation. I was an hour late to work. That's because I woke up with gut-wrenching pain this morning, recently diagnosed with an acute gluten resistance, which I've been treating with Vicodin, can you believe it, until my doctor on an offhand comment said, why don't you try giving up wheat? Why don't you try gluten-free? It had, in 3 days, my medical conditions, the primary medical conditions, were gone. What to eat? First, she says, just remember, even the...
You just sit back just a tad.
Yes, just remember that, why wheat? Why wheat? I've always eaten organic. I'm an Oregonian. I've supported this since the beginnings of Oregon Hill. It's in me. I'm there. Why not wheat? She said, just remember, in the United States, no wheat is good any longer. It's just become compromised. All right, my second choice is soy. Well, I'm sorry, she says. Soy is going that route again. But oat is good. Then I get on the internet and I look around and I'm thinking, oats, it's also debatable. Because I learned that the whatever flies between the plots can go from the wheat over to oats without even knowing it. And really, when I go to my trusted Bob's Red Mill choices, Bob even has non-gluten oats. So that's not what I put. So anyway, that's my story personally, but the reason I'm here today, I've never testified. I've probably written one or two times to Ron Wyden in the last 25 years, but I was appalled that Oregon was doing this, because we are community-based. Everyone here probably began their career by being inspired with Oregon, with community organization, and in order to help. And then again, the spirit of Oregon going back to its origins with Oregon Tilth, which have come so far, we know how to do this, and we know how to do it right for everyone. And I just urge the Senate and the Scoop and Governor Kitzhaber to take it off the table for now and let it give its proper attention. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for being here today. Thank you all for testifying.
Thank you for listening.
You're welcome. Okay. Colleagues, I think that concludes the public testimony, but I did have, there was some interest perhaps in hearing from Legislative Council, and so I guess I would want to put up, actually, let me close the public hearing.
Madam Chair.
Excuse me 1 second, Senator.
For the public hearing, I'd like to make a comment on what I'd heard today about this issue.
If
on
I
LC5.
Could. Yes, and we'll get back to that. Thank you, Senator. We could have Elsie come in the morning and talk about this, but if they're still available, I can have them come now. I think somebody had a particular...
Good morning.
I'm not even sure they're still here, but I wanted to prioritize the public testimony first. So if you have questions specific to what we hope will be LC5 online, colleagues, to ask Elsie, we can get those in the morning. So Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Manager. Simply to respond to the... allusions to the unapproved GE wheat in Eastern Oregon. I hope people aren't using that as some example of windblown, unintentional cross-pollinization. The fact of the matter is this was a case of intentional planting. I think the investigation that is ongoing will eventually demonstrate that there was a criminal act involved. In that outplantings, I'll just remind folks here that Oregon has had more convictions for ecotage than any Western state. I will just say that it is a very poor evidence that there's lack of regulation. There's a very clear indication, in my way of thinking, that because this GM wheat appeared magically like a crop circle in the night, somebody planted it. And it's no coincidence that I think it was intended to disrupt markets and harm producers. And it very nearly did that. So I will just tell you that using that as an example of why we should pull back from state regulation, I think that does more harm to your case than good. That's all I wish to say, Madam Chair. I wish that Senator Hansel was here, because I think he has some real strong opinions perhaps some personal experience and expertise in the wheat ranching business that might lead folks to conclude that that was no accident that GM wheat appeared in.
It shows what a dangerous technology it is.
It shows that there are people.
Excuse me.
Madam Chair, thank you. I just wish to illustrate there are people that feel so passionate about this, they will do things that are irrational and possibly illegal. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks, Senator. And so we'll have Legislative Council here in the morning. And again, we apologize for not having LC5 online, but we hope to have that by tomorrow. What I will say just to conclude is I want to say thank you again to all those who testified and those who have watched online. Putting together legislation is always a little difficult, but this is a more complicated process than normal. And I think we're all impressed with the depth and the passion on all sides of the issue, and we've heard it. We will read your testimony, and we will be back tomorrow talking specifically about LC 3 and 4, the revenue side and expenditure side of the proposed package for Monday's special session. We also take additional testimony on all the LCs as well tomorrow, if for those of you who weren't able to make it here this afternoon. And with that, colleagues, we will see you at 9 a.m. sharp. Thank you. We're adjourned. Thank you. We're adjourned.